Yeah, this is a caterer. You having a party over there?
Not
far away at 313-298-WRIF. Last week we had Dave calling in from Shanghai, China. And at first I said, how do I know that you're calling in from Shanghai? And then he very, very quickly, trying to make these major adjustments on the microphone as we speak. Sometimes making, man, that is making some weird noise. Either that or there's mice in here. Anyways, so Dave sent some email, of which seems to have immediately gotten lost here, but he sent some interesting, I mean, I believed him. Now, here it is. He said, Dave writing from Shanghai, China, thanks for taking my call on WRIF. It was a pleasure talking to you about the State of the Union address. Doesn't that seem like that was like months ago? There's something about Bushko, yeah, this current regime, that makes everything seem like years, doesn't it? He said, you asked, how do I know you're really calling from Shanghai, China? He says, good question. My wife and I were invited by our landlord and his wife to celebrate Chinese New Year tonight. By the way, the rent here is $6,200 a month. And over dinner, I mentioned to them about the radio conversation we had today. They don't speak a word of English, but my wife is Chinese and does all the translating for me. I asked them, how would they prove that I was calling from Shanghai? They laughed, and his wife said, you should have just opened the door. The fireworks have been going off all day and night for the past few days in celebration of the new year, and if I had opened the door, you surely would have heard it. Here are a few compressed pictures of downtown Shanghai taken from the local TV station, and Shanghai has about 18 million people and about one-tenth as many cars, about a third as many bicycles. During rush hour, it typically takes 1 hour to go 18 miles on the expressway. That's no different than in Chicago. Well, what are the big stories? You know, and forget about weapons of mass destruction or stuff like that, the economy. I mean, now it's all Janet Jackson and Justin Timberlake. I didn't even see this, but this was the Super Bowl. The New England Patriots taking, what was their final score? 28? 21, something like that. Anyways, New England Patriots over the Carolina Panthers. And I forget, a third of everybody in the United States is watching it? Wow. So they had this halftime show. You're going to have to tell me about it if you want. I mean, we could talk about things that really matter in life, but what the hell? We're not known for that as Americans. 313-298-WRIF. So they have this halftime show. This has just been related to me by a number of people. And Justin Timberlake is dancing with Janet Jackson, kind of dirty dancing as it was described to me, and he like takes off her bra. I mean, tell me if I'm, you know, wrong as well. And, you know, turned out though she had little things covering chapter 11. I guess I can say it. Can't you say that now? Nipples. Yeah, I can say almost anything on radio. So there's now, it's just, you know, everybody's blown apart by this and, you know, family, this and that, and no, I don't know. But, I mean, I don't mean to say it that disparagingly. I don't have a family in the sense of small children, and, you know, that's offensive to some people, I guess. But times sure have changed. It's Super Bowl I, what was it, 66, 1966 or something like that? They had people like Carol Channing on. Now it's Kid Rock and Aerosmith and Janet Jackson and Justin Timberlake, Dirty Dancing. And they have P. Diddy on, too. I mean, so things have changed. You know, things have changed significantly. Well, maybe the phones are lighting up about that. But I wanted to raise something. And those of you who have been to my website at peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E.com, peterwerbe.com, there's a song on there called I Hate Republicans. I'm going to play it in just a little bit for you. Let me see if I got to push a bunch of buttons, though, don't I, here? Should have done this in advance, I guess. Oh, yeah. All right. I think this will do it. Anyways, this is an incredible song. And I don't like the word hate. I mean, hate, anger, rage, we talk about that a lot. I mean, that's what fuels the ugliness that we see all around the world. I mean, if you didn't hate people, you couldn't do the things to them that that people do to one another. Right? I mean, you can't say there is a good person who I may disagree with a little, but they have all the human characteristics and qualities that I do. So, I mean, you just get maybe a little irked that we don't see eye to eye. If you dehumanize them, if you hate them, then, well, anything is permissible. So, the fact that the song, it's a group called the Happy Tones, and it's called I Hate Republicans. It's on my website if you want to kind of hear it in advance. But I don't know. I mean, I find the song very appealing, I have to say. And I was, and in fact, I someone sent it to me, and I put it on my website. And let me see if it says here this week on Peter's show. Let me see. I got to stretch this out a little. Can you hate Republicans and still be against right-wing hate radio? Because right-wing hate radio over the last 10 or 12 years has really done a lot to incite hatred of minorities, of women, of gays, of environmentalists. I mean, even to the point of reviling them to the extent that people perpetrate violence against them. Particularly, you know, the people that are most at risk, people like gays, minorities. And in many parts of the country, you get this right-wing hate radio, and aimed against, of all people, the major target. You know, you get a Montana like that, you don't have a lot of minority groups, so it's like taking out an environmentalist. And there was a right-wing, I visited Montana, when was this, I guess November 2002, part of this national broadcasting I was doing for a while. And there we went up to Kalispec. What the hell's the name of that town? Something like that. Kalispec? Somebody remind me. You're listening in Montana, 313-298-WRIF, or call talkyes at yahoo.com. And there was some, you know, like, more like, well, I don't even want to say this guy. I mean, I don't know why. I mean, he is so vile. I mean, he makes Rush Limbaugh seem like a liberal. Anyways, you get a lot of wannabes, and they go, whoa, these guys, you know, they're spewing all these lies and hatred and, you know, right-wing crap-a-roo. So, so that encourages other people to do it. And since they don't let liberals or leftists or progressives on national radio, it's not like there's any other model. So somebody in talk radio wants to be a success, so you got to mimic. You got to mimic these big, you know, strutting, rich right-wingers who have these talk shows that are in bed with the Republican Party. And you know they are, because they brag about golfing with the president, sleeping at the White House, and all that. We were talking about that last week. They have no critical distance whatsoever. I think the town was Kalispell. So anyways, some right-wing, you know, wannabe guy I'm not mentioning, he's got environmentalists on his website, particular people, and he's got like bullseyes, or what do you call them, crosshairs. And crosshairs. And because people want to save the environment. All right, so we'll play that in just a second. But I'm remiss not to mention probably the biggest story and the way it is being misportrayed. And finally, Bush, under mounting political pressure, is going to sign an executive order to establish a full-blown investigation. This is the phrase. This is the operative phrase. U.S. intelligence failures in Iraq because this, Republican Party stalwart loyalist David Kay, who was the former chief U.S. weapons inspector, said that the belief that weapons of mass destruction, that Iraq had weapons of mass destruction, were wrong. And there, as both the United States and Britain grappled with controversy over why they went to war against Saddam Hussein. Well, you know, if it wasn't weapons of mass destruction, we'll make up something else. And David Kay said, let me begin by saying we were almost all wrong, and I certainly include myself here. This is somebody who thought there was weapons of mass destruction. I believe that the effort that has been directed to this point has been sufficiently intense that it is highly unlikely that there were large stockpiles of deployed, militarized, chemical and biological weapons there. And this is portrayed, then, as this intelligence failure, this word over and over and over again. From the London Observer, U.S. officials knew last May that Iraq possessed no weapons of mass destruction. Senior American officials concluded at the beginning of last May that there were no weapons of mass destruction. Intelligence sources, policymakers, and weapons inspectors familiar with the details of the hunt for weapons of mass destruction told the Observer that it was widely known that Iraq had no weapons of mass destruction within 3 weeks of Baghdad falling, despite the assertions of senior Bush administration figures and the British Prime Minister, Tony Blair. So this big lie continued. Cheney, to this day, the vile, evil Cheney, keeps asserting this. The disclosure that U.S. military survey teams sent to visit suspected sites of weapons of mass destruction, remember, they knew right where they all were. And this was like an immediate danger, and they had all these graphs and charts and photographs and everything like that. All turned out to be BS. Almost said the real word. I don't know. Can you say that now? You can almost say anything, right? I mean, if Janet Jackson can flip them out at the Super Bowl, why can't I say what BS stands for? Okay. And here is what I think. And tell me what you think. 313-298-WRI. This wasn't an intelligence failure at all. This wasn't misinformation. This was lies. Total lies. From the beginning, I mean, all we have to do is read Paul O'Neill's account. He's a former Secretary of the Treasury. His best-selling now, number one bestseller in America, The Price of Loyalty, he says from day one, they're talking about how can we invade and occupy Iraq, part of the whole, and you're saying, I don't know, like that. So this is part of the whole project for a new American century. Well, if this is the first time you've ever heard about this, and you've got strong opinions on the situation in Iraq, like, I still support it, whatever, and you don't even know what the Project for a New American Century is, maybe you ought to just kind of take those opinions and put them off to the side and do a little research. Because, this is all going to come out, that it was a lie, that it was manufactured, that nobody seriously believed that. Now, what happened once, it's hard to say. During the 17th century in the colonies here in the United States, there were these witch hunts. People went around searching for witches and burning them at the stake. Now, did these men who were burning these women as witches and drowning them and doing other and torturing them, did they actually believe they were witches? You say, well, yeah, that was kind of superstitious beliefs they had at that particular time. But what was going on was, there's a number of things. First, many cases, property was seized by these women. These were sometimes women whose husbands had died. So it was a property grab. I mean, they always say follow the money, right? And also, women who were healers and the midwives and things like that, good upright Christians, kind of the... what would you say? I can't remember the big word for it, but the relatives of the people, like the John Ashcrofts that are running stuff here. That was them back then. So did they believe it? They believed it. Yeah. I mean, I think when people are shown, I mean, for instance, the senators like Kerry or Sander, or not Sander, but Carl Levin, the senator from Michigan, when they're shown this material that shows, 500 tons of anthrax are here. They go, well, gee, these guys wouldn't lie. Well, they did. And some of you, the younger you are listening to this broadcast right now, the better off you are. Because if you're like 14 or 15, and I get emails at calltalkyes@yahoo.com from 14 and 15-year-olds all the time, this will all come out. I mean, a lot of us, I mean, we could be long gone or, kind of doddering by the time the evidence comes out. And when it comes out, when all the details of the lies, and you learn that there wasn't for a second that Cheney or Bush or Rumsfeld or Powell actually believed that that Saddam Hussein had any weapons of mass destruction, you'll go, and you'll be like 45 or something like that, and you'll say, there was a guy back in the early part of the century that said that. I can't remember his name, and it was on a radio station. Hopefully WRIF will still be around, celebrating its 100th anniversary or something. But, okay, so that aside. All right, let's get back to this thing, and I'm going to play this for you, and hopefully this will just go. This is the Happy Tones. It's called I Hate Republicans, and I'm wondering whether you think this contradicts the sense that I have elsewhere on the website, on mine, peterwerby.com, that says, stop hate radio. So we're saying that the Republicans, the right-wingers, foster hate against members of our community. They're toxic. Well, tell me if you think this serves the same function. And let's hope that this damn thing plays, and I've done this right. If not, hi, Rick Fox. He's our producer and phone screener for the night, and for some reason or other, it's probably... Everything has slowed down so much on the internet because of this My Doom. This really usually just comes up right away. That's coming very slowly. And I can't, this is just going to open and start, so I can't just take a call right now. But let me see if there's anything else going on here. While this is loading, it's one of those things where it's got these dots. The economy as well grew by like 4%, and yet it's still not producing the number of jobs necessary to overcome the ones that have been lost under Bush, almost 3 million. I think in December, wasn't it, like 1,000 jobs were created, and I think it was a wash in January. Let's do this. Let's just hold on this baby because We've got some people waiting, and that seems to be opening pretty slowly. So we'll start right now. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Hi, it's Peter Werby.
Hi, Peter. It's Matt from St. Clair Shores.
Hi, I'm sorry I didn't get your name.
Matt.
Matt. Hi, Matt.
Hi. You know, I think it's interesting that you mentioned the Janet Jackson thing, and also that CBS rejected that ad put out by MoveOn.org.
Oh, yeah. Isn't that interesting? Now, let me just bring people up to speed on that real quickly. MoveOn.org had this contest for 30-second commercials that were in opposition to Bush policy. So the one that won was called Child's Pay, essentially asserting that our kids are, you know, our children are going to be the ones that are going to be paying for this enormous debt that the Bush regime has run up. And CBS refused to play it during the Super Bowl.
Yeah, I had the chance to see Howard Dean today. He's in Roseville.
Really?
And I noticed as the Democrats are starting to come out, one of the issues that I don't notice being addressed is the fuel economy standard.
Uh-huh.
And it's interesting that the car of the year over at the auto show was actually a hybrid car. And do you see this as being an issue in the election?
Well, you know, I don't know that it will, because the United Auto Workers, I think to its disgrace, opposes raising the fuel requirements, or the standards, the CAFE standards. What does that mean again? I forgot.
It's corporate average fuel economy.
What is it?
Corporate average fuel economy.
First word is corporate?
Yes.
Huh, okay. I guess I wouldn't have remembered. Anyways, so the UAW opposes it. It's a big supporter of the Democratic Party, so most of the Democrats will probably leave that alone, to its shame.
Okay, just wanted to touch on that.
All right, thank you so much. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Let's see if we can get our song on again a little quicker. No. Man, this is really weird. It's not even coming close to opening. Well, I'm going to just let it sit there and see what happens. It might blast out in the middle of one of your calls. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, man, how you doing?
Doing well.
This is Sean. I'm calling from my school. I kind of want to vent about the, it's not a big deal in the scheme of things, but about the Super Bowl and how it's, like, not really much about the Super Bowl anymore. It's more about, like, people are watching for the commercials. They're watching for the pregame. They're watching for the halftime, and it's so annoying because it takes away so much from the game that's what everyone's talking about. And the majority of people watching aren't even football fans, and it's just so annoying. I was wondering what you thought about that.
Well, it's kind of like a national holiday or national. I mean, we don't get the day off, or we do because it's Sunday. That'd have Super Bowl Monday and give us another day off. How's that?
That'd be a good idea.
Right. Well, yeah, you're right, but I don't know. I mean, I don't care much about the Patriots, the Pats, or the Panthers. I mean, did you care who won?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I cared who won. I'm an Eagles fan, you know, so I was kind of rooting for Carolina since they had knocked the Eagles out. But I mean, it's just kind of annoying that everyone's, like, you know, we want to talk to people about the game and stuff, and people are like, oh, man, did you see the new Budweiser commercial? Did you see that? And you're like, did you see the game-winning field goal? I mean, you know, people are just totally off the topic, you know.
Well, hey, Sean, what about the Janet Jackson, Justin Timberlake thing? Did you see that?
Yeah, I didn't know what was going on because I was sitting there, I was watching with my buddy and my parents at our house, and like, we saw it, and we're like, what the heck just happened? Like, we thought, like, it wasn't on accident at first, but then we're like, you know, with the words of the song, it seemed like it was on purpose, and then we actually thought, like, maybe it was like a skin-colored outfit or something. But I guess someone else said there was like a star covering her. Or area or whatever.
I guess we can say nipple now. We're modern. We're in the 21st century. Wow.
I'm a conservative by heart, so, yeah.
All right, Sean.
All right, thanks for taking my call.
Take it easy. Conservative by heart. IWRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, I haven't met.
What's your name?
I want to talk about the Iraq War.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay. Yeah, how you doing?
Well.
Peter, were we?
Yeah.
You're the best, man.
Well, thank you.
Yeah, I guess I'd say about the Iraq War.
Mm-hmm.
You know, instead of, like, the Super Bowl and all that crap, we got to think about them guys dying, you know, and all that stuff, you know what I'm saying? Like,
yeah, I wonder how all those parents feel and all those families.
Right. You know, who cares about the Super Bowl? Who wins, loses? But, you know, when we start thinking about, you know, whose kids aren't coming back home, and what's the stand up for the, you know, national anthem and take your hat off and all that kind of stuff.
But, well, you know, You can do both. I mean, the problem is that the fact that that there's just bombs going off all over Iraq. You know, more U.S. soldiers have been killed over the last couple of days. But you know, I think this is beginning to seep through the Baltimore. What's the newspaper there? The Baltimore Sun, mainstream newspaper, says Americans deserve Bush's profound apologies. Says, imagine that you are the parent or the brother or sister, the wife, husband or child of a young man or woman killed in Iraq, one of the 138 who died in the march on Baghdad, or one of the 384 who have died there since May 1st. Imagine, for that matter, that your loved one is among the almost 3,000 men and women who have been wounded in Iraq since the war began, many of whom will forever bear their horrible injuries as a reminder of where they were and why. The why of it, says G. Jefferson Price, the prospective editor, the why of it was torn apart last week. Imagine, he says, how appalled the friends and the beloved of Iraq's casualties must have been last week to hear David Kaye, the recently retired chief U.S. weapons inspector in Iraq, tell the world, well, it turns out we were all wrong. I said last week, and I probably shouldn't even be flippant because there is so much death and suffering by this pyramid of lies constructed by Bush and his pals, that it would be like Truman saying at the end of World War II, after 400,000 Americans died, and say, you know, we made a mistake. Japan didn't bomb Pearl Harbor, but... the world's better off without Japan. At the end of this, this editor at the Baltimore Sun says, America is now trapped in Iraq, unprepared for the war's aftermath. It is a complex and deadly trap. The war on terrorism, meanwhile, is not over. Underlying the mess was the ugly suspicion that the only people to get any lasting benefit from the war will be Bush's friends with multi-billion-dollar contracts. He says, no wonder there is rage in America, and that rage won't die down. The most enraged Americans must be the families and friends of the men and women who have died in Iraq because of this huge error. And like I said, I don't think it's an error. Bush, he says, owes them a profound apology and a persuasive reassurance that it won't ever happen again, with or without him. All right, thank you so much. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Now, I don't think the human mind can deal with that. There are these. I should have more access to. But there are these groups like Military Families Against the War and Veterans for Peace. I think they're just at veteransforpeace.org and what have you. That are family. So there are family groups out there that are opposing the war. But if you lost a loved one, I don't think you can face the fact of this loss or this grave injury because of an ideological desire to have an empire for oil. I don't think that you could... I don't know if I could. I don't know if the men and women that are going to come back after spending a year or more and having their tours extended beyond what their contract called for are going to be able to say, we were just there, we just risked our lives, took lives, saw our friends get blown apart, saw innocent civilians get killed because of a Bush lie. I don't know if the mind can do that. Well, after a while, that happened in Vietnam. John Kerry, to his credit, was one of the leaders of a group called Vietnam Veterans Against the War. And these were veterans who came back and who were spit upon. You know that image of the Vietnam veteran being spat upon. Except these were men that were spat upon by, like, American Legion guys from the Korean War and the Second World War. These were veterans that were spat upon by pro-war, right-wing supporters of Nixon back then. And John Kerry what's a guy born on 4th of July? I can't think of his name right now. Anyways, they led incredible marches, hundreds, sometimes thousands of Vietnam veterans during the war, while the war was still raging, to say no to this war. And many of them, there was something here in Detroit called the Winter Soldier investigation, where they testified to things like the My Lai massacre and what have you. So maybe it'll happen again. I don't know. This Bush guy has really got us in a fix. All right, let's go back to our phones. I'm Peter Werby. This is Night Call. Hi, this is WRIF, and you're on the air.
Hey, Peter.
Hi.
Hey, how you doing?
Good.
I don't get to listen to you much, but I heard you a couple weeks ago, and you were talking about how we never should have entered World War II.
What? Wait. You're severe. And that's what always frightens me, that it's not like reading when you can see something, you go, hey, what did it say? And then you read it again. When did I ever say we shouldn't have entered World War II?
You know, it's been, I don't remember completely, but I was going to applaud you on it as far as the fact of, compared to Iraq, where people compare Iraq to Hitler a lot, or Saddam to Hitler, but we had proof Japan attacked us.
I know.
Which makes sense. We definitely should have attacked Japan. But we had no reason to go after Germany. We had no proof that Germany attacked us or had any harm towards us.
Well, I think what it was Germany declared war on us because they had an alliance, what was called the Axis, the alliance, and they declared war on us. And there was also this concern that the Nazis were going to overrun Europe, take Britain and France's colonies.
Well, that definitely makes sense. And if Iraq would have done the same thing and Saddam Hussein would have declared war on us, I mean, that would have been a different story. But we should have definitely had proof that he was doing something. I mean, even if, for say, it was a mushroom cloud over anywhere, at least that was proof. But
now,
we didn't have any proof.
There was no proof. In fact, all of that was just lies.
Yeah.
Just lies.
I mean, I would definitely prefer going to war with half of whatever gone, rather than going to war with nothing.
Hmm? One more time?
Well, I would have preferred, instead of going to war with no proof that nothing was going on, I would have preferred going to war with, you know, New York gone or L.A. gone.
Oh, yeah. Well, yeah, I mean, there was no reason to, there was not even the slightest reason to suspect that Saddam Hussein represented any threat whatsoever. I mean, I was saying this, as soon as Bush began this in August of 2002, I mean, there was enough information out there to know that this was completely fabricated, and he was using this to take people's mind off of the fact that this Enron scandal could have, just eaten his administration alive, as it should have. I mean, and so then, you know, they started all this fear. The mushroom cloud, you know, we don't want to know, you know, we don't want the first warning to be a mushroom cloud. I mean, it's totally insane. I mean, Saddam Hussein didn't have any weapon systems, wasn't creating any weapon systems, didn't have the capacity to create any weapon systems, and certainly didn't have any capacity to strike at the United States. Had no connection to September 11th, and had no connection with Al-Qaeda. And that's why all of these people in the intelligence community that had any integrity got out. And that's why, for instance, you can see them on this film called Iraq, The Real Story or The Real Truth or something like that. All right, thank you. Appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. It's Night Call. You're on the air. Hi.
Hello, sir.
Hi.
Misdirected liberals are fun to spar with, so I enjoy your take on some of these thoughts. Michael here. I have some issues with, one, your reference to Bush as pursuing an oil empire, I believe, which is, of course, ridiculous in the scope of OPEC and the global economy and how it dictates the oil markets and what we would be doing with that oil now had that actually been the intent.
I have to say that given what a stupendous failure that aspect of it is, I mean, you got to remember these shifty characters that inhabit the White House. They got a new story every week, and Rumsfeld said we don't have to worry about the costs of reconstruction because the oil that will be produced once we get Iraq up and running will pay for it. Well, now you don't hear anything about that at all.
I think in typical fashion, that would be taken totally out of context in that is meant to, and if you look at the entirety of that speech, that is representing how Iraq is rebuilding itself, not how we are harvesting their surpluses to fund Dick Cheney's pockets, who is, I don't remember the adjective which you referred to him with, but it was quite interesting. And the other interesting thing that you mentioned was just about the lie in its entirety. And my question for you would be, why, if something has been, as you have painted it to be, largely exposed as a lie,
mm-hmm.
at what point do you continue to perpetuate that lie and not cut bait and run? Or And another issue on the weapons of mass destruction that supposedly were never there and they were never pursuing, obviously in recent weeks, which I haven't heard you mention, there's discovery of trace elements of things coming to and from Iraq and being shipped over to Syria.
Well, no, I mean, those things come and they go, trace elements. We're talking about whole weapon systems that were supposed to be on 45-minute readiness. We were Bush was peddling this nonsense about unmanned drones that could drop chemical weapons on the United States from these ships that Iraq had, you know, circling the globe and all that. Listen, there was never the slightest reason ever to suspect even that Saddam Hussein had any weapon systems or that was a threat to the region. This was totally fabricated. There's not even an element of it that approaches the truth. It's nothing about faulty intelligence. It has to do with the desire to make war at a particular time, long planned by these far right-wing ideologues, and this was the time they were going to play the Iraq card. I mean, you get you know, a good Republican who says he's going to vote for George Bush again, the Secretary of the Treasury, the ex, you know, Paul O'Neill, says they started talking about it on day one. You read in Rumsfeld's notes that at Rada, the day of September 11th, can we use this to attack SH, you know, Saddam Hussein. These, you know, that old expression, warmongering, is the perfect description for these people, and they, but, you know, their arrogance and their self-assuredness, maybe that's the same thing, is been broken on the rock of reality. And they haven't the slightest, I don't know what, integrity or strength of character to admit it. They are monumental failures. And everything they've ever done in foreign policy, most of what they've done in their businesses, mark them as failures. But they are so wealthy, they are so well connected, they are so part of this ongoing racket that they never have to pay the consequences. The economy gets screwed up, we pay for that. Stockholders in their businesses, whether it's Halliburton or you know, or Harkin Oil or all those other ones, they're the ones that pay the cost. They make a mistake by backing Saddam Hussein, then who pays for it? Kuwaitis, Iraqis, and American soldiers. These guys should be, a lot of people have been calling for the impeachment of George W. Bush and his cronies. I'd say that they ought to be in the world court. That's what I think.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Peter will be back to take more calls right after this.
The biggest football game of the season is almost here, so pick up plenty of chips and Dean's Dip. Then visit deansdip.com and enter your UPC code for a chance to win a trip to that big postseason game in Honolulu. In Hawaii, football is called Kine Popopeku. And if you win, you'll be the big kahuna. When your friends beg to go with you, you'll tell them to kiss your va'a and take your vahine instead. Maybe she'll wear that lole au-au you bought her and give you a wiki-wiki little honi before the game. And then, thanks to Dean's Dip, you'll pa'i-pa'i and ho'olana until you're both blue in the face. So pick up Dean's Dip at participating Spartan stores today and get ready to win a trip to the big game in Honolulu. Dean's Dip. After all, it wouldn't be Kine Popo Peku without it.
No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited. Must be a legal U.S. resident 18 or older to enter. All entries must be received by 2204.
By crikey, we've been hunting down an unbeatable deal on Chevrolets, especially the ultimate utility vehicle, the Avalanche, and the unique Trailblazer.
Steve, better be careful. There are some man-eating dealers out there.
Terry's right. If I'm not careful, I could get bit right in my wallet by one of those snakes. That's why I'm going to Joe Pinion Chevrolet, the unbeatable dealer.
That's right. Joe Pinion Chevrolet is the unbeatable dealer, with 9 glorious acres of vehicles.
Plus, they'll beat any price, and get a load of this. They even have the hard to 2003 Chevy Blazer. Plenty in stock and ready for immediate delivery.
Watch out, Steve! Other dealers only claim to give the best service, but at Joe Pinion Chevrolet, they stand by their word.
Here we are. Isn't it gorgeous? Joe Pinion Chevrolet in Southfield with Telegraph Beat 696, across from the Town 12 Mall.
Good job, Steve!
Check this out. Joe Pinion Chevrolet, the unbeatable dealer. 1-866-JOE-1111. That's 866-JOE-1111.
Chevrolet and American Revolution.
The Motor City's best rock station, 101 WRIF, and the best radio website in the world, WRIF.com, brings the hottest deals in the Motor City. Now, WRIF.com makes your night on the town even better without hitting your wallet with Dine Online. You are now one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price.
Dine Online and eat for less with WRIF.com.
Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's premier restaurants.
Like Kinker's All-American Grill on Plymouth Road in Livonia. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price.
But quantities are limited, so hurry and order your half-price certificates now.
Dine Online.
It's all from the station that delivers you more.
101 The Riff.
101 WRIF gives you the best deals in Detroit at WRIF.com. Check out special offers and savings from Motor City businesses.
Like Buddy's Pizza, recognized as one of the nation's 5 best pizza places by the Food Network.
Log on today and save.
With the home of rock and roll
at WRIF.com.
Here's a message for all you parents of snowboarders. Whether they're riding Fakie on Sick Pow or Goofy and Skank, whether they're boning it out or rolling down the windows, whether they stick in the freshies or eat it hard after some Helleline air, one thing's for shwees, they're going to be stoked for some food. No matter what language you speak, Dinty Moore beef stew is a well-balanced meal, especially after a wizard session of biffing dinosaurs on the steeps and scoping the mad steez. Dinty Moore, an excellent choice.
Demand Hormel Chili Seminar, tape number 3.
All right, guys, it's time for you to get a makeover. Replace that old flannel shirt with a new flannel shirt. Trade in that widescreen TV for a wider screen TV. And instead of sitting on the couch all night doing nothing, sit on the couch all night eating Hormel Chili. You'll feel like a new man. Hormel Chili. Demand it.
You're listening to Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show with Peter Werby. Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF. If you're on hold trying to get on the show, please stand by. If the lines are busy, please try again.
Thank you very much. Welcome back. Just got this email from Shelby LaPree. Now, Shelby runs radiopower.org, and they repeat this show every Monday, 5 p.m. to 8 p.m., and he says, we've given you another time slot. So this program, the one you're listening to right now, the one that you can get on by calling 313-298-WRIF, it's going to be repeated tomorrow, Monday, 9 a.m. to noon and 5 to 8 p.m. Eastern Time. You can go to my website, peterwerby.com, W-E-R-B-E.com. And I had this whole show planned around the idea that I was going to play this song called I Hate Republicans, and it just won't play. Some of you have been listening because you... and it's just opening forever. And, just usually comes up like that. And I wanted to raise the idea of, we're always talking about how hate-filled Republicans are and how toxic these right-wing talk show hosts are to our communities. And so I'm wondering, I love this song. Everybody I know who hears it loves it. But then hate is such an awful word. It's not talking... One of my loyal listeners is WRIF's evening jock, Meltdown. He's here rocking every evening. And one of the best, and a Republican. I mean, his father is a Republican office holder. And so I just played that, and I'm going out thinking, I hate Republicans. And then I run into Meltdown, and we kind of jive about politics. But he's the nicest guy in the world. I don't hate him. But the images, see, that's what's going to be missing if we ever get this thing up and playing. The images are of the power people within the Republican Party, mostly. Not entirely, but mostly. But I don't hate them either. I mean, I don't hate George W. Bush. I despise everything about his policies despise a lot of this arrogance and what have you. But here is, someone wrote in about that. Debbie, by the way, wrote in from Boston at calltalkyes@yahoo.com to say that I was trying to think of, let me see if I've got that right, of Ron Kovic. That was the 4th of, born on the 4th of July, Very, very good movie. Very moving movie as well. Let's see. Gary writes in, I really enjoyed the song, I Hate Republicans. It is, however, hypocritical to preach tolerance and understanding to these right-wing freaks on one hand, and on the other scream about how much we hate them. Pardon me. Let's leave the hate speech to the conservatives. Would love to hear you talk a little about the film The Corporation, which is opening here in Canada in a few days. Let's spread the word. Actually, I don't know anything about it. Rick Fox, you ever hear of it? No, me neither. This is J.A. writing from New Haven, Connecticut. Michael Moore delivered a talk in Grand Rapids, and over 2,000 people were there to hear what he had to say. Other than what's in the Grand Rapids press, do you know any more about this? No, J.A., don't know a thing, unfortunately. Michael gets thousands. His book is still up there in the top five. Number one bestseller this week is Paul O'Neill's book, The Price of Loyalty, where he exposes the racket of the Bush administration, what he was part of. All right, and I've still got I Hate Republic. Is anybody, have you tried to open it, Rick? Why don't you try to do it? Just go to my website, peterwerby.com, and because it sure ain't opening here, and it usually opens very, very quickly. What line am I going to in the meantime? Thank you. All right. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, how you doing?
Doing great.
All right, I just got to say I love Bush and Russell.
Okay, well, thank you. That's quite all right. I mean, if you weren't screaming, I would have let you say why. Our next call... All right. Hi, WRIF. You're on the air. Good evening.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm Mike from Farmington Hills.
Hi, Mike.
I just wanted to talk about the Kay report.
Sure. Where David Kay said, I guess we were wrong. No weapons of mass destruction.
Well, actually, I think you're blurring the timelines a little bit. The Kay report actually does say one of the basic facts is that Saddam Hussein did, in fact, commission weapons of mass destruction. And the CIA knew about it, British intelligence knew about it, and just about the entire world knew about it, and the UN knew about it, most of them. He acknowledges that, and he says that that was, in fact, a fact. The fact that he didn't have them shows that the scientists that he commissioned them from defied his orders. Now, what the CIA did not know was that those scientists, save Mr. Rison, defied those orders. So you can say, yeah, that the intelligence was flawed, but it's flawed to the extent that they didn't know that those scientists that he commissioned were disobeying his orders.
Well, but there's a lot more to it. I mean, the weapons inspectors who were pulled out by Clinton in 1998, they said that, I'm not doing well with names tonight, but, big guy, ex-Marine, actually voted for Bush. Do you happen to remember his name? He's always on television. Anyways, he said that he could say with assuredness, because he had been on the ground as a UN weapons inspector from 91 to 98, that Saddam Hussein had no appreciable weapons, had no capacity whatsoever to launch any attack. And the other thing is, there's no reason to think that he had the intention to, because given the pasting that he had received in 1991, that was a shadow army. It was an army of dust. And previously, because of the United States aid and what have you, he had built up this enormous force with weapons of mass destruction and a capacity and a willingness to use it. One of the reasons that that countries want weapons is they think that it'll forestall U.S. invasions. In fact, it does. So the United States knew in advance that there were no weapons of mass destruction as it invaded, whereas they didn't invade North Korea because they feared, in fact, that they had weapons. So, it is just a big lie, I think.
Well, the Kay report did say that he had full intention of making weapons of mass destruction. So.
Well, let's say that it did. There's a couple of things working. The United Nations had inspectors in Iraq at the time. And they said they needed a little bit more time. And, you know, these terrible, what were they, cheese-eating surrender monkeys like the French, they said, let's wait another 30 days. Because then maybe we won't have hundreds and hundreds of Americans dead, thousands wounded. We won't have 10,000 civilians killed. This kind of collapse of Iraqi society, and all funded in the billions by you and me. So we have schools closing and classrooms extended in size and everything like that. And the French wanted to wait another month but Bush knew if they waited one more month, it would become crystal clear to everyone that there were no weapons of mass destruction, because everywhere the UN inspectors went, they said, we don't find any. And I knew they weren't going to find any. Anybody that moved beyond the fabrications of the Bush regime knew there weren't any. Tens of, 10 million people about a year ago, one of these dates coming up, February 14th or something, throughout the world knew that Saddam Hussein didn't have any. Do you think that, I say this rhetorically, but I will ask you directly, Mike, do you think that me or my wife and I flew to New York to take part in this demonstration with a million people in it that virtually, shut down the east side of Manhattan in 15-degree weather to say no to this war? But, if I would have thought that Saddam Hussein would have had the capacity and the will to harm this country or even other countries, I might have been there on another thing. Go get Saddam. Take him out. But we knew, and we were right, and the Bushies were wrong. All the smart, rich guys were dead wrong. That's what David Kaye said. Well, I guess we were wrong. In the meantime, the mountain of corpses grows, doesn't it?
Well, I would agree with that argument. If you substitute knew, as in you knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction, with something like you could feel that there was no, you could sense it, because nobody knew.
No, wait, we knew. Here's how we knew. We knew the history from 91 to 98, and the inspectors that were in there, there's also intelligence, there's spies and all of this. We knew that that at least, according to, and someone, let me see, I can probably get in the email, that according to the chief weapons inspector, that 95% of, okay, thank you, John. John, let me see on something. Scott Ritter is the man that I was, his name is Scott Ritter, and he voted for GW, but this time he's voting Democratic, by the way, and he's backing Dennis Kucinich. All right, I love Dennis. But in any event, Scott Ritter was there. You can just go to your web, if you got a computer, assume you do. You can go to Scott Ritter, and it'll all be there. He said 95%. He can guarantee, because that was his job, this Republican ex-Marine that said it was his job to find weapons of mass destruction, and by 1998, 5% of them, all, that he could guarantee 95% were gone. And the other 5%, he didn't say they were there, he just said he couldn't guarantee them. We put inspectors back in there. They search everywhere, and suddenly it's going to become crystal clear that there are not any. That everything that Bush said, everything that Rumsfeld, everything that Cheney, everything that Powell said was a line of fabrication. So they said, well, screw the United Nations. We're gonna commit a crime against peace, because the threat is so imminent, so immediate, so direly threatening, that if we don't invade Iraq right now, we're going to be hit hammered ourselves. Well, that wasn't true, and that's the reason that they invaded. That's the reason that the Bush administration is now an outlaw regime.
An outlaw regime, I would disagree with you on that. But
well, if you break international law, why did Saddam Hussein or any other... this was a crime against peace. The United Nations is the only body that can authorize this. There was a resolution that said, we have to do this, and if not, there'll be real consequences. Well, the inspectors were allowed in. They were allowed to go everywhere they wanted. They were allowed to go to the palaces because they thought maybe they'd have like a nuclear laboratory under a palace. Nothing, nada, naught, none. There's not a thing. And I don't know whether Saddam Hussein was being fooled or what, but the main people that were being fooled were the people of England and the United States.
Among many others, too.
Well, the people of Spain, or the people of England weren't fooled. They overwhelmingly opposed it. The people of Spain overwhelmingly opposed it, our erstwhile allies. I mean, you had to have this faith in not only just politicians, which anytime, you know, anybody wants me to do that, Democrats or Republicans, but particularly Republicans, and particularly Republicans without a bit of scruples, and a particularly Republicans that have a real bad history, and particularly Republicans that were all tied in with supporting the Saddam Hussein regime in the 1980s, and particularly somebody like Donald Rumsfeld, the Secretary of War, who after he'd committed these crimes, said, oh, yeah, it's all right. And then, and in 1983, it was Rumsfeld who brought a pair of golden spurs to Saddam Hussein and said, you're our boy in the Middle East. Thank you, Mike. Appreciate it. 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. Hi, it's Peter Werbe, and you're on the air.
Hi, Peter. This is Mike Hamlin.
Mike Hamlin, my old buddy.
Yeah. Listen, Peter, before I get to what I call you, but I need to be able to get in touch with you. Will you have somebody give me a number after I get through talking?
Yeah, right. Okay. Or you can just call the main number of WRIF and ask for my voicemail. That'd be wonderful to see. I haven't seen you in years.
Yeah, I thought I might see you down at the Fog of War.
That's a whole other story. I didn't. That's too long. Yeah, but go ahead. I heard that was that's about Robert Strange McNamara.
Yes, Strange.
That's his real middle name, folks.
Yeah. I've been wanting to call you. I called last week and I couldn't get in. So, but I wanted to talk about this job loss that we're experiencing.
Okay.
Job shifting around, and the people of the state of Michigan have reaping the whirlwind of England's legacy, England and the Republicans. By the way, play the song, because I can assure you, if you don't hate them, they hate you.
Right.
Yeah. Let's be very clear about that. Hate you.
But wait, yeah, that is true. They do. But yeah. Think about everybody from the Dalai Lama to Martin Luther King and what have you. You know, I mean, hate eats us up, right?
Yeah. Well,
that's why they're so eaten up.
Well, Dalai Lama and Martin Luther King and Gandhi were special people. I wasn't one of those. That wasn't my attack.
Okay.
Anyway, the Republicans were out of power for years and years. They were out of the majority in Congress for 40 years, and then Michigan, Williams and Democrats held the legislature for all these years. So they had to resort to they had begun these dastardly tactics, picking up on Wallace's program, and in Michigan. What they did give these workers who were prospering during good times in the economy the red meat of anti-black, anti-affirmative action, anti-welfare, anti-taxes. English came in on a platform of no taxes. No welfare, affirmative action, and in other words, we'll keep the blacks in that place. And the people went along with that, and they're still going along with it. But that allowed him then to do what he wanted to do in terms of regulation, in terms of who he appointed to judicial office, in terms of laws that he could get through the legislature that were anti-workers, anti-working class people and poor people, and we got to this place now, and we're kind of hamstrung, and our jobs are leaving, and of course the same is true on a national scale with Bush and the Republicans, Tom Lee, and so
mm-hmm.
Had Clinton in a box and intimidated, and so. When this Electrolux thing happened in Grand Rapids, where they closed down this plant.
Western Michigan, yeah.
Yeah, eliminating 2,700 jobs, which is primarily going to affect white workers, probably 90-95% of them are white workers. And there's not anything else coming in. How ironic, because that is the Republican bastion.
Yeah, this will give them an idea of, you know, even in their desperation that they try to identify with the party, they're masters, and even that's not enough to save them. Because the loyalty that they have to, these ideals, or I don't know if you call them ideals even, or, you know, these tenets of the Republican Party, it's not reciprocal. In other words, the rulers, the wealthy, they have no loyalty whatsoever to their workers, to the community, to the state, anything. What they're looking for, essentially, is to create an international model. That is to say that what the kind of working standards and wage standards and living standards that prevail in these third world countries, that's the model that they want from here. It's not the opposite way. In fact, they don't want that to occur. They don't want third world workers to say, well, hey, wait a minute, guys up in Detroit are making like $24 an hour with benefits. What they want is to have that third world model to be the universal model. Hey, Mike, I don't know how late you're going to be up, but in an hour I'm going to play an interview I did earlier with Diedrich Mohammed, who is the author of a study called State of the Dream 2004. And it talks about, it was shocking that many of the conditions in the black community that you would think had improved greatly are the same or worse than they were a generation ago. And the first question, that I asked Diedrich Mohammed was, this audience is primarily Euro-American, so, you might get people listening say, well, I don't care, or, hey, that's good, I'm on top.
You'd be surprised. Some of my friends listen to you. In fact, they turned me on to you.
Well, good. But the point being, he answers that question about what effect, this isn't just a crying towel, although I think it's all right if we all weep some tears for what's happening to our country and our economy, but this is an issue that presents itself as racial, but ultimately has this deeply embedded class factor that affects all of the working class and all of the middle class, regardless of your ethnicity.
2 points, Peter, and then I'll let you go. One is that the Republican policy, in the context of this deterioration in the economy, will be to offer up the scapegoat, Hispanic workers, the so-called legal out in California and Arizona, et cetera, and, of course, blacks and gays and put the poor and people on welfare and the homeless, et cetera. And these folks will take that scapegoat. That's what they're going to give the Electrolux workers. I wonder what they did with the Enron workers in Texas. The other point was, are you familiar with this book that came out several years ago called Ordinary Germans, I think it was called? I have long, and from my perspective, from the perspective of astute black person in this country, watching the dynamics and watching what happened with in the South and with the Republicans and race and Bush going, Bob Jones, etc., I get the sense that at least half of the American population is in that kind of position that the ordinary Germans who supported Hitler and who, in fact, he enabled him to do what he did. And, in fact, it wasn't just Hitler. It was people loyal, dedicated to the program and the principles that he put forward. And there's just, there's a veil of hatred over a large segment of this population. They're talking about it now in the South.
Well, it is. In fact, I'm looking at the clock, Mike, and I got to get some of these
commercials. Thank you.
Well, wait, but I just did want to say that, there is this rage that is present here of blunted expectations and fear of job loss and fear of deteriorating communities. And it is important. I think you hit one of the key words, scapegoat, that rather than looking at the scapegoat for scapegoats, it's important for us to look around, look at the class structure of this society, see who's benefiting, see who's threatened, see who's taking the losses. Mike, again, let me urge you, because I'd sure like to hook up with you again. Just call the WRIF main number.
I will.
And they'll direct you either to my, I'll be in my office tomorrow, or my voicemail will be there.
I'm certainly looking forward to it, Peter. Thank you.
Great.
Keep up the good work.
Great. Yeah, Mike Hamlin, a guy who's done so much in the city of Detroit over the years. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Night Call with Peter Werby on 101 WRIF Detroit. Our number, 313-298-WRIF. Peter will be back to take more calls right after this.
If you want the glory, then you better have the guts.
The Super Snowcross Stadium Tour, February 7th.
The Silverdome.
It's unbelievable indoor snowmobile racing.
On the harshest snowpack track ever built.
Featuring the best riders on the planet.
Sean the Sniper Crapo.
Lunch and Levi Lavallee.
Defending champion Blair Superman Morgan and more.
See freestyler Jimmy Blaze perform the backflip live on his Yamaha SX Viper. Advanced kid seats are just $10.
That's right.
Advanced kid seats just $10.
So don't wait. Get your tickets now at Ticketmaster, the box office, or charge by phone at 248-645-6666.
Or online at Ticketmaster.com.
Tickets subject to convenience and handling charges.
All seats $2 off with a free pit pass with advanced purchase.
It's a snow flying, ink scraping, snowmobile racing showdown.
The Super Snowcross Stadium Tour.
Presented by Parts Unlimited and Bud Light.
February 7th.
The Silverdome.
Men, how'd you like to last even longer in the bedroom? Now you can with Maxtral, the new climax control system for men. Maxtral lets you last longer than you ever thought possible, so you can prolong the pleasure and maximize the control. Maxtral is scientifically formulated to give you the kind of stamina you want and a woman never forgets. Maxtral is for men of all ages. It's available without a prescription, and it can give you more satisfaction than ever before. Now you can make the pleasure go on and on with Maxtral, maximum control for men. Ask your doctor about Maxtral or call now and try Maxtral risk-free for 30 days. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708. Prolong the pleasure, maximize the control, and see how much longer you last with Maxtral. Call 1-800-256-6708. 1-800-256-6708.
So, David, I know you do all kinds of loans, but what about the larger loan amounts? Can you handle those?
You talking to me?
Yeah. Oh, yeah, that's right. You're the mortgage expert. Of course you can handle those.
Absolutely. How about up to $1 million? Very little down, no out-of-pocket, and smaller monthly payments than you'd imagine.
Now I think I must be dreaming.
No, it's true. It's our interest-only loan. The sky's the limit. Exclusive and innovation from the mortgage experts.
So what if your loan is normal size, like most of us?
Haven't you heard? We're bringing Wall Street to Main Street. Interest-only loans aren't just for the big-timers anymore. You know, in 2003... we helped nearly 100,000 clients. Those were big and small loan amounts.
So size matters. It's incredible. And you're still ready for more, huh?
You said it, I didn't. That's right. More in 2004. Here we go.
Call Rock Financial, 800-333-ROCK, or go on rockfinancial.com. The mortgage experts. Big loans, smaller loans, purchase, refinance, consolidate debt. They do it all. 800-333-ROCK. A Quicken Loans company, equal housing lender.
Here we are.
You're listening to Night Call, the Riff's phone-in talk show with Peter Werby. Our phone number is 313-298-WRIF. If you're on hold trying to get on the show, please stand by. If the lines are busy, please try again.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. This is WRIF in Detroit. This talk show with your calls goes to 1 o'clock, and then we'll be letting you listen to a couple of interesting interviews. One I just mentioned. The other one is with David Petorti. And David lost a brother on September 11th in the World Trade Center, and he's going to be in our town on Tuesday at 7 o'clock at Bookbeat Books, or just The Bookbeat. I wonder how that is. Bookbeat Bookstore. And The Bookbeat is in the Lincoln Shopping Center in Oak Park, and it's at, what would that be, 10 and a half mile and Greenfield. On Greenfield, 10 and a half in the Lincoln Shopping Center. So I'm going to check him out. David Petorti and at Bookbeat in Oak Park, an independent bookstore. Here's what's happening. We can't seem to play any of these songs on my website. And because of this damn internet virus, my doom, who they're going after, the SEO Corporation and Microsoft. In fact, that SEO shut down its website because of this huge attack on it. Not that I have any sympathy for these big corporations, but, in their, we're like collateral damage. You know, we're like the civilians that get killed in one of these military operations. So I can't get this song on the air. So we'll have to do it next week. In the meantime, if you know what we're talking about, this song called I Hate Republicans. And the question was, is, you know, if we say that, if we like this song, if we identify with its lyrics, are we involving in the same kind of intolerance that we always accuse? No, not like we always accuse that these right wingers are actually characterized by, I would say. All right, so that was one thing. Nobody ever talked much more about the Super Bowl, and I mean, you know, this is like the big deal that Janet Jackson had her top ripped off by Justin Timberlake. But you know, maybe rightly so. Why am I bringing? Am I pandering there? All right. Who knows? Let's go back to our phones. 313-298-WRIF. Hi, it's Night Call. You're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Peter. How you doing?
Doing good, thanks.
Hey, good to talk to you. I am a conservative, and it's good to hear that you don't hate me.
No, I don't.
Good. I mean, because when you really break it down, you know, we are all people, and we're all trying for a better world for ourselves, our kids, our country, and the world.
Mm-hmm.
And we have different views and philosophies on how to go about it, but that's, you know, debate is what makes this country great. So, kind of a hard call for me to make, because I'm going to actually agree with you on a couple points here. First one's pretty quick, and that has to do with my belief in, one of the things I believe in as a conservative is personal responsibility and accountability for your own life and your actions, and it really, really ticks me off to listen to Rush Limbaugh now and listen to him try to play the
victim
card.
The victim. He was always so critical of people that played the victim card. Now he's just whining.
Yeah, I don't listen to him very often. I mostly listen to shows that, you know, like your kind of show where, because I know where I stand, and I don't need to listen to someone who I agree with. I like listening to someone who has an opposing viewpoint.
Where do you ever find other people on radio that have different viewpoints?
Yeah, not very often.
Right.
Pretty much you and Mike Malloy.
Mike Malloy, my buddy.
Yeah, but I listened to him a couple times this week, and he starts this whole show. He talks about how he's like the victim of a zealous prosecutor, and
this is Rush Limbaugh we're
really,
talking about. Yeah,
it really bothers me. You know, I mean, it just. Yeah, maybe I agree with him on a lot of viewpoints, but you know, if he's screwed up, he's got to pay the cost.
Well, he doesn't want to. That's for sure.
He doesn't want to, and he may not because you know, the legal system, and if he got money. But I think he should. I really do.
There's a few people that are going to pay the price of the arrogance of wealth. Fortunately, maybe Martha Stewart, maybe Ken Lay, and maybe Rush Limbaugh.
Yeah, I just wanted to let you know that that really upsets me. I mean, I'm a conservative, so I should be supporting them, and a lot of my friends do, and you know, they get upset with me when I say that, you know, what I say, they say, well, he is a victim. It's like, no, he's not.
Well, I mean, he is and he isn't. I mean, the addiction is a pretty tough thing. I mean, Ann Coulter, this right-wing wacko pundit, she said, liberals have finally met a drug addict they don't like. Which I thought was actually a fairly funny line. I don't dislike drug addicts. I've known any number of people with drug and alcohol problems, as most of us have, particularly with alcohol, have known people in our own families. And what they need is medical help, emotional help, and support. And I would offer that, and in fact, at some level, I even do to Limbaugh. But the fact, that of his hypocritical statements in the past about that anybody that breaks the drug laws ought to go to jail, I've said to some people, that they ought to just tell me, well, you go to the Florida State Pen, Rush, and just put the fear of whoever he fears into him, and then just legalize it all. Because, I mean, he has not committed a criminal act that is that should come to the attention of the state. It should come to the attention of his medical the people, his caregivers, but like I say, it's his it's his hypocrisy, I think, that has everybody so up in arms.
And you know, there's mountains of hypocrisy on both sides, and this one is just a real shining example of the hypocrisy on the right when people start defending him and saying that he's a victim of the prosecution. I just totally disagree with that. He should, you know, I mean, he's a victim of drug abuse. He's a victim of drug dependency, but he's not a victim of an overzealous prosecutor. That's just a crazy line. It really upsets me.
All right, thank you very much.
Oh, I have one more point.
Sure.
Do you have time?
Yeah.
The other one, it's not so much that I'm agreeing with you, but I'm going to tell you a story, and I think you're going to completely agree with me on this.
Okay.
That's I know you don't watch much TV, but if you did, you might have seen an interview with I'm forgetting his name. Tim Russert. Tim Russert. He was interviewing Al Franken and Tucker Carlson.
Right.
And Al Franken actually got Tucker Carlson to admit that in an interview that he had with George Bush before the election, Tucker Carlson asked him maybe you remember her name. There was a woman that was executed in Texas.
Right.
I don't remember her name, but
I don't either.
He asked him if she was standing in front of you, what do you think she might say to you? And George Bush came back with, she'd probably say, please don't kill me, please don't kill me, please don't kill me.
Yeah.
And I don't know, that just that right there was the first time when it really made me sit back and say, you know, because I mean, I've always felt that he had good character. And hearing that, just, if he has that much disregard for life, and I support capital punishment, but you gotta take it seriously if you're taking someone's life, and if he's not taking it seriously on her, I just wonder how seriously he's taking the lives of our soldiers that are dying overseas.
Well, he's off fundraising while they're dying. Listen, it's not like I think... I was just writing something about this, that somehow in the 90s, it was the golden age of America, and we had these wonderful, honest politicians that weren't beholden to the corporations and all of that. It's just another part of the racket. I mean, I don't understand the idealization of Clinton and Gore, and I certainly don't understand that of Bush. I mean, at absolute best, politicians are a necessary evil, and I would debate that sometime. And when people begin trusting everything they say. I mean, first thing I do, any politician of any party says anything, you want to just put your hand in on your, you know, your back pocket, hold on to your wallet. When it comes to war, even more so. And the idea that anybody would believe, this is my, you can call it cynicism or realism, that any politician starts giving the reasons that we have to go to war, whether it's Lyndon Baines Johnson lying about the reasons for the war in Vietnam or George Bush, in our era now, It for anyone to believe it at face value, I think, is a horrible mistake, because then you have to later on think, damn, I believe that guy, and there's lots of people dead. I mean, it was my old friend Mike who mentioned this film called The Fog of War.
Mm-hmm.
And you know what that is?
No.
Okay, it's this documentary with Robert McNamara, whose middle name really is Strange.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's Robert Strange McNamara, and he was the president of Ford Motor, and he presided over the escalations on Johnson's behalf of the war in Vietnam, and he now says that. And he knew that these attacks on these ships in the Tonkin Bay were not so. And he kind of blithely, I mean, sometimes blithely from what I've heard from it, and sometimes, sadly says, my decisions led to 3.5 million Vietnamese and 60,000 Americans dying. I mean, this is, think how we judged Hitler. And and everybody's got a good reason. All these politicians always have great reasons of why our soldiers should go and kill other people. And the fact that there's thousands, or in the case of Vietnam, millions that die, well, that's because... Yeah. So, these are great questions that I think ought to be made with plenty suspicion.
Yeah, yeah.
All right, thank you.
Thanks, have a good night.
Appreciate it. Bye now. Yeah, The Fog of War. I said it was too long to tell Mike why I didn't want to see it. It just, seeing films about Vietnam just make me too angry and too sad. And to see the face of this man who was responsible for death and destruction of that magnitude, and the fact that he's going to die a wealthy man in a bed surrounded by his loved ones, rather than experiencing something like Eichmann did, one of the architects of the Holocaust, is a little bit more than I can take, to tell you the truth. Harsh, you think? Tell me, or tell me anything. I'm Peter Werbe, and it's Night Call at 313-298-WRIF. Hi, you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, how you doing?
Good.
I don't know, you guys talk so much, and I was on hold for so long. Now there's, like, so much I want to say, but I'm going to try and cut to the chase here.
Sure.
All right. To me, you guys are talking about Rush Limbaugh, and I would say I'm more conservative, but I'm more moderate, too, you know, but... To me, I like listening to you, just like listening to Rush. It's almost the same rhetoric, just on different sides. Over here, you got him saying, oh, the liberals are doing this, and don't trust them, and they're weird, and this and that. Then you got you on the other side saying the same thing, oh, the conspiracy with the war is this, and you can't trust no politician. It's almost like every point you made is mute now by saying you can't trust anyone. You got to trust some people. That's the basic. And necessary evil, I don't really consider necessary evil. We elect these people. They're human beings. They're going to make mistakes, but... Everyone, I think liberals, conservatives, everyone, there are some people out there that want to do damage to the other person, but in all likelihood, I just think most people are just really trying to get, you know, to get this country back on track, get it good. I mean, we've had some bad times, had some good times under Clinton, but all this rhetoric from this side, oh, they're doing this, and now you just said something about, I really don't know too much about this McNamara guy who killed all this, and talk about Hitler, and I mean, comparing this guy to Hitler, I mean, it just, I don't understand, like, sometimes where you're coming out with so many points, and you'll get someone like me on the phone or someone else trying to make a point, and you have all this information in front of you, and throw this at, but to the average person, someone like me, yeah, I get my news from the newscast. You know, I'll read some books here and there, but, I'll drive in my car, listen to the radio.
But the point being that if you have the information that's only presented to us through the corporate media, which tends to be very conservative, you're going to come out with that point of view. So it's like, here you have now this phrase about this invasion of Iraq. They're talking it was based on faulty intelligence. I'm saying, you know, you can call this rhetoric or whatever you'd like. I mean, you're welcome to. I'm saying it was purposeful lies, that they knew that that Saddam Hussein didn't have any weapons of mass destruction, but constructed, fabricated this charge in order to justify this war. Well, either it's true or it's not true. And so how do you, as you say, how does an average person... sort it all out. I guess you have to, unfortunately, you can't go to just the casual sources that are available to us. Turn on CNN or Fox or read the Detroit News or something like that. You're going to kind of come out where you started. And so, I mean, I agree with it's daunting, and I'm sorry I have so much information. It's just...
It's not the problem they have so much information, but... You have so much information. On the same hand, so does Rush Limbaugh, and so does this other guy, and so does this other guy. And that's your job, is to have this information and to give it to people. But the thing that I'm saying is what the rhetoric is, that you have someone that's conservative that'll get this information and spin it to his advantage, but then you'll have a liberal get this information and spin it to their advantage. You're just caught in the middle. So it's kind of like, all right, I listen to this for entertainment and for information. A lot of times, your radio, just like what you're saying, Rush is going to say something on the other side. This guy's saying, sometimes, really, the media that's out there, you just got to put it on Fox, get a conservative point of view, throw it on CNN, get the other side of point of view. They don't got as much time. They don't got as much information. Like, they don't throw it out as much as, you know, a 2-3 hour show is with people calling, you know, getting their viewpoints in.
Yeah, but wait a minute.
Kind of take it and, like, kind of separate it into what you think it is. But I don't understand how you or Rush can sit there and say, oh, they're trying to do this, or this was all fabricated, this and that. I don't think it was all fabricated.
Well,
I don't think it was all lies. There's a point where you sound like, oh, it was lies, and now we have to believe you. It's your opinion, and you're entitled to it, but I think you should put it out there in a way where this is what I believe, this is what it should be.
I got you. But listen, I don't have to start every sentence with saying, I believe. I mean, that's pretty obvious. But... Wait a minute. I mean, since August of 2002, when Bush began this assertion that Saddam Hussein had weapons of mass destruction, I said they didn't. They didn't have any. I used a million arguments. I cited all sorts of people that had been there and knew about it, and I kept saying there wasn't, there wasn't, there wasn't. So you're saying, how can you ever affirm one's assertions? Well, the Rush Limbaughs in the Republican loyalists kept, you know, repeating the same thing that came from the White House. But now, I mean, what am I supposed to say? I told you so. Here is this Republican that was in charge of finding these weapons, and he says we were almost all wrong, including, and I certainly include myself here. This is what David Kay, the former chief U.S. weapons instructor or hunter, said. And, I mean, there's certain things, for instance, you know, again, I mean, I collect this kind of information. You know, we have this this tax policy, and we say that Bush is ruining the economy. Well, he's presided over the loss of 3 million jobs. The country is in this massive deficit that previously it wasn't. It had a surplus. The rich are getting richer. The poor are getting poorer. He wants to take overtime pay away from people. I mean, this isn't an opinion. This isn't rhetoric. This isn't spin. And there is a connection between tax cuts and the fact that there's larger school class sizes we know in our community. The roads are getting crappier. There's reduced access to health care. We have to pay higher fees for everything. And at the same time, tens of billions of dollars are going to these firms that are destroying Iraq after these firms that are Bush's buddies destroyed it. So, I mean, this is a racket. And so part of it is information, facts, and then the conclusion is that it's a racket.
But okay, now that's your conclusion. But now if I took everything you said, let's say I had all the source of information, or just say I was like a Republican politician, I could come back with certain other things to dispute your point.
Well, of course. I would love to debate any right-winger. I mean, bring them on, to quote some guy. And when I say that, you know, hundreds of Americans aren't going to die. But I would debate Rush Limbaugh, Sean Hannity. And see, one of the things that they do, maybe I do the same thing. I'm going to do it now. Hey, I got to go.
Go ahead. I would just like to see a show that where you and let's get like a poll other conservative, someone that totally feels different about it, and like not like a Hannity and Colbert show where they just bullshit all the time. Sorry if I come down if I say that on the air, but
I was wondering whether I could. Yeah, go ahead.
A real debate between you and another guy. Not that I'm either way, but then I think that way when there's a real debate and just like I'd like to listen to you and like let's say you and Rush together, like just totally, you know, bang it out to each other, say, you know, this is what we believe, this is what I believe, like.
I got you, but listen, Rush, you know, he just signed a contract for $750 million. You know, so I'll do it for 10% of that.
Exactly, but if someone gave you a contract for them, would you have signed it too? Because I would too.
Oh, sure, I would too. I would too. All right, got to go.
All right, thank you.
Thank you. All right, I mean, I grant you, unless you're already committed to a certain perspective of politics, it gets real crazy. You go, wait a minute, I just saw all this on television, and they said this was all the way it was, and then I turn on WRIF, and here's this guy saying none of this is true. This is from United for a Fair Economy. When you have progressive taxes and regressive taxes, progressive taxes means the less you make, the less taxes you pay. The more you make, the more taxes that you pay. It says let me see here. In virtually every state in America, low-income people pay much higher shares of their income in state and local taxes than do their wealthy neighbors. Not saying they're paying, you know, if somebody's making $15,000 a year, they're not paying more taxes than someone that's making $600,000 in absolute dollars, but that in fact they are paying a higher share of their income. They pay more tax, more of a percentage of their taxes. Let me see here. Also, I said the connection between tax cuts and larger, all the stuff that we're suffering now. How tax policy over the last 20 years pardon me, has shifted taxes from investor income to wage income and from federal level to the state and local level. So it's shifted taxes from investor income. These are, you know, the people that are up in there in that top 5% that get the majority of their income off of dividends from the stocks that they hold. It's been shifted from there to the average middle class and working class person. Let me see if there's anything more to this. This has resulted in a shift in overall tax burden from the wealthy to the rest of the Americans. So the people that need income the least, let me phrase that a better way. People that don't need more income than they're already getting are getting more. And those of us, the vast majority, probably 85% of us that here, we're paying more and more of our taxes and getting squat from it. I mean, if we're paying, I don't know if this is easily available, this is the same thing. Actually, I mentioned this when it was beginning. This is from Baghdad. New Iraq agency to hunt rebels. Because, you know, you still have, I say, boy, they're way down. They're only making 20 attacks on Americans a day. It used to be 60 back in November, although this was one of the deadliest months. The Iraqi authorities, with the help of American intelligence agencies, are creating an intelligence service that will focus on rooting out guerrilla fighters. The service will employ some former agents of Saddam Hussein's security apparatus. How about that? They're going to take these guys from the secret police of Saddam Hussein, and they're going to say, oh, you're rehabilitated. Did you violate anybody's human rights? No, sir. Okay, you're here. And here is the kicker in this. The service will employ 500 to 2,000 people. That's quite a range. Any bureaucracy knows that if it says 500 to 2,000, look for it soon to employ 3,000. Well, there is no Iraq government, so who's paying it? Now, you know the answer. Conservative, liberal, you know, whomever, who you are. You know who's going to pay it. It's you and me. Every single one of us. Disproportionately if you're in the middle class or the working class. And this is what it says. It will probably receive financing from the American government. And where does the American government get its money? It gets it from you and me. And then when it's instead creating some intelligence apparatus that's staffed in part by former agents of Saddam Hussein's security service, it's going to them. And, you know, and by the way, it'll partly go to pay their salaries, but it will go to these consulting firms and these American security firms. So essentially what we're doing, we're working, and then rather having our kids in schools that have like 15 kids so the teacher can teach right, or rather than creating these cities that should be jewels instead of these slums, we're going to be paying these Bush-friendly American corporations and paying off ex-Saddam Hussein security agents. Ain't that sweet? Rick, thank you very much. Are you on tonight? Okay. Rick Fox, also a DJ here on WRIF. What'd you say? Three, right. All right. Yeah, how do I do this? There it is. Hi. Night call, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi.
Hi.
I had heard all the comments and stuff from everything that you've been talking about, and pretty much what I was going to say, I'm going to sum it up with, I think the problem, the problem is that we define people as Republican or liberal or conservative or whatever, and it's generally wealthy people want to keep their wealth, and it doesn't matter, like you see movie stars and they go over to and they supposedly are helping people over in other countries, and predominantly actors and actresses are liberal, but they want to keep their wealth just like everybody else. And I think the whole thing about America is you have a right to be wealthy, whether it's politically correct or not.
I mean, this country was started by wealthy people, and they were concerned that their wealth couldn't be expanded to the extent that it was possible because of the way the British Crown was functioning. But how wealth is distributed is a social and political question. For instance, in the Scandinavian countries, the divergence between wealth and middle class and poor is nowhere like it is here. This is like a third world. This is like Guatemala or Mexico, where you have, and increasingly so you have this highly waged sector. I mean, it's not as bad as that, but you have extremes like you don't have in any industrial country in the world. It used to be, up till 1960, that incomes over $5 million had a 90% tax on it. So, in other words, for every million over $5 million, or $6 million, I forget, $5 million, I think, that it was, you got to keep $100,000. And that's who paid a substantial amount of the, you know, who shouldered a substantial amount of the tax burden. And now, though, it's gone the other way, because beginning with, guess who, not any conservative, but with John Kennedy in 1960, those were repealed, so the ultra-wealthy paid less and less taxes, and the country still needed to field this enormous military apparatus. So that burden over the last two generations has been shifted onto the middle class and the working class. So we could go back the other way.
Yeah, well, I mean, I agree with that aspect that the wealth or the money shouldn't be projected onto the working class people, but they have business people who have said that even if the money was spread out to all the people, that in 20 years it would be back in the same hands.
That's not true. I mean, taxes are a way of wealth distribution, and conservatives really hate that sense. But what the idea is, if you have tremendous differentials of wealth and poverty, is, I mean, who gets the ultimate power? Who's able to buy lawmakers and buy elections? I mean, you have a situation where Bush, because of his pro-corporation policies, is going to wind up raising somewhere between $150 and $200 million in order to, I shouldn't say reelected, because he wasn't elected the first time. But the wealth distorts the capacity to run a democratic system. And as you say, that this is a capitalist country, and like those Scandinavian countries, which are capitalist as well, they have wealthy people, and they actually have considerable influence as there as well. But you don't have they don't have that many people, but we've got tens of millions of poor people, many of them who work their butts off every day, but are paid so damn poorly, and things are going in the opposite direction. It's not like wages are increasing. I mean, we pay people $5.50 an hour. I mean, that's the minimum wage. Minimum wage ought to be about $10 or $12 an hour. But suddenly that the American worker is put in competition with foreign workers, where these companies are all too happy just to leave our communities for. All right, I got to take a break. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for checking out WRIF.com. While you're here, don't forget to join the Riff Cyber Crew. It's your ticket to a totally unfair internet advantage for the Riff on-air giveaways.
Plus, you can win stuff that we don't even give away on the air.
Awesome internet exclusives from WRIF.com and much more.
Oh, that sounds great.
Make sure you sign up with the Riff Cyber Crew today.
Just click over to the Cyber Crew page while you're listening.
Any questions?
And thanks again for listening.
It's a dream.
It's a miracle.
It's great for women, too.
WRIF.com.
More Riff Rock is coming right up.
Hello. How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
What a great time talking to Billy Bob Thornton about his new movie, Bad Santa.
And you've brought anal sex into the mainstream.
Well, I do what I can for the cause.
I like the idea that not only have you brought that into the mainstream, but it's on fat chicks as well.
That's right.
Okay, so who's PO'd about the movie? Somebody's got to be bitching about it.
They got to stir up controversy about everything. All of a sudden, it's like, it's a Santa Claus movie, and he's like cursing, and it's not about Santa Claus, it's about a con artist.
Yeah,
right.
I have to tell you, I appreciated John Ritter, but I didn't realize he had as much range as he had until you worked with him.
I'm really proud of the fact that I got to put him in a movie that showed him as an actor.
What was his famous line? Was it, we're going to have to bleep this, he said, stick, was that it?
Yeah. I also like the part where he says, he's talking about what he heard, overheard at the big and tall. and he can't even say the word, he spells it.
Oh, yeah, about another anal sex reference.
That's right.
I ain't listening to you no more.
Stop it!
Drew.
That sounds good.
And Mike.
I hear you.
In the morning.
Each of us has to set his own standards, I guess.
On the Riff.
That's good.
101
WRIF. Ow, you're shouting at me.
The Motor City's best rock station, 101 WRIF, and the best radio website in the world, WRIF.com, brings the hottest deals in the Motor City. Now, WRIF.com makes your night on the town even better without hitting your wallet with Dine Online. You are now one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price.
Dine Online and eat for less with WRIF.com.
Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's premier restaurants.
Like McVee's on Telegraph Road in Southfield. You can purchase full price gifts
gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price.
But quantities are limited, so hurry and order your half-price certificates now.
Dine online.
It's all from the station that delivers you more.
101 The Riff.
101 WRIF gives you the best deals in Detroit at WRIF.com. Check out special offers and savings from Motor City businesses.
Like Buddy's Pizza, recognized as one of the nation's five best pizza places by the Food Network.
Log on today and save
with the home of rock and roll
at WRIF.com.
You're logged on at WRIF.com. We'll get back to more Riff Rock in just a moment.
Hello. How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
We got some great celebrity phone numbers. We had to try them. First, we called the 49ers' Terrell Owens, and then Brian Urlacher's girlfriend, Paris Hilton.
You have reached the Sprint voice mailbox of
81.
To leave a voice message, press 1.
Terrell, this is Jeff Garcia. I just want to say I'm not supposed to have a little cry with you the other day. It was real nice seeing you cried, too, because I knew you cared. I love you. Bye, T.O. Giving him rides
before. It's Paris. My screen is broken on my phone, so therefore I cannot read any of the numbers on it. So make sure to leave a number with the message, and I will get back to you as soon as I can. Thanks. Bye.
Hey, Paris. It's 54 here. Big Brian. Just think about putting it in your butt. Boom. Always say PH. How about a big 5-4? Up the old Yeah, I was thinking of running a post pattern right up the middle. When I see a hole, you know me, I got to plug it up. Didn't mean to total a damn thing.
Good thing you love it.
Drew.
That sounds good.
And Mike.
I hear you.
In the morning.
Each of us has to set his own standards, I guess.
On the Riff.
That's good.
101.1
WRIF.
Ow, you're shouting at me.
The Motor City's best rock station, 101 WRIF, and the best radio website in the world, WRIF.com, brings the hottest deals in the Motor City. Now, WRIF.com makes your night on the town even better without hitting your wallet with Dine Online. You are now one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less with WRIF.com.
Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's premier restaurants.
Like the Shark Club on Ford Road in Canton. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price.
But quantities are limited, so hurry and order your half-price certificates now.
Dine online.
It's all from the station that delivers you more.
Your view is hard to find. He should be smart enough to know that. Thanks, Peter. Keep doing what you do. We're also talking about the information that turned out to not be there, that there were any weapons of mass destruction. And I said that it was clear that the United States invaded Iraq because it knew in advance it had no weapons. If it did have weapons like North Korea, it wouldn't have. And let's see who Victor writes in to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. The reason the U.S. will not attack North Korea is because it is not a cakewalk. North Korea has an air force. You remember that Saddam Hussein did not. North Korea has lots of missiles, including the Sunburn that they acquired from Russia. The Sunburn is the most deadly missile in the world at the present time. Has the capability to sink our aircraft carriers. At the present time, the U.S. Navy does not have a defense against this missile. So by now, you should start getting clear why we do not want to start a tango with North Korea. You can do a Google search and verify this information. Victor says the U.S. Has a tendency to pick fights with third world countries that are almost defenseless against the U.S. war machine. Another reason why the U.S. Will tango with North Korea is that the U.S. will suffer a great number of casualties, and a country does not have the stomach to take that many. I mean, I don't have a stomach to take what we're having, hey? All right, let's go back to our calls. I've lost my sheet totally. Are we going to line? Okay, line 4. Thank you, Rick. Hi, WRIF, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Hi, Pete.
Hi.
Great show tonight.
Thanks.
They left off the most important reason we can't go to war again is we can't afford it, you know.
Yeah, and nor do they have the troops. They just said they could expand, I think, like an executive order to expand the military by 20,000 or 30,000. Are young people joining the Army still? I mean, they think, hey, I'm going to get a college education if I don't get my face shot off in Iraq.
Well, if they make people hopeless enough about ever finding a job, you know, what choice do they have?
But there you go.
I wanted to, I've actually heard a good number of I guess, conservative people calling in tonight, which is, you know, you get a few, but I have more than usual. And I take that as a kind of hopeful sign, because I think it's maybe some of them, in the light of this continuous, you know, this unraveling of our national policies, that, you know, the firmament of our economy and our political respect and our entire democracy, it may be giving them, you know, they may be breaking out of the spell of the Rush Limbaughs and the Sean Hannitys of the world. And I wanted to give them a couple of chains of thought that they might follow.
Mm-hmm.
If, and this is just for everyone, but I think I particularly see these days that conservatives really, and I've heard on a few of your callers' voice, they think that they're so educated and us liberals are just bleeding hearts that don't think anything through, that we act on our emotions. And, you know, we just want to care for people when, you know, we want to care for the Osama bin Ladens of the world when they really just want to kill us and, you know.
Right.
Things like that, very simplistic way of thinking. They're so educated and, you know, we're just so emotionally driven. When I, you know, to me it's the opposite, because most conservatives here, you know, if they've read a book, it certainly isn't about politics or economics. And they're the first to condemn Marxism, which I'm not a Marxist, but they're the first to condemn it, and they've never read anything by Karl Marx. If I asked most of them, who was Karl Marx? Was he a Russian? You know, was he? You know, they'd say yes, because they don't know. And you know, I have asked this question.
Well, that is dumb conservatives, then.
Well, that's most. I mean, most of them really don't know, to be honest. I mean, and I've talked to a lot of people. They really do not know when Marx lived, what he wrote about. They haven't read the Communist Manifesto. They haven't read even their own treatise. They don't know who Milton Friedman is. You know, I mean, but what I wanted to say about a few, let's follow these chains of thought and just start asking the questions. Number one, how does the U.S. economy work? I mean, and if you look at it, you can see we have these giant corporations that do not really compete with anyone. They form cartels and monopolies and extract wealth from the rest of us through tax policy and monopoly pricing. It's not about competition. Competition is for the little guy to try and eke out a living. And once you get big enough, then you can start buying political friends and getting government contracts. And even if you're really incompetent, you can usually make it, and you have to be colossally incompetent, like people at Enron, and you still get away with it.
Well, ultimately, though, is it about is it about facts? I mean, we've talked that before about authoritarian personalities and submission to powerful people, the fear of independence. Eric Fromm, F-R-O-M-M, had a book called The Escape from Freedom and talked about the different type of personalities that inhabit our political systems. One is a democratic personality with a small d, nothing to do with the Democratic Party, and the other is the authoritarian personality who loves authority, who loves authority figures, who's in many ways never matured beyond a child who is both fearful and respectful of these father figures. Well, it's all right when you're 3 years old or 8 years old or what have you, but when you're 35 years old and you're still just submitting to anybody who in authority, no matter how they got there, whether they're a king or a dictator, because a lot of people love dictators. You know, a lot of people loved Saddam Hussein. A lot of people loved Hitler. A lot of people loved Stalin. It's not like you had every single person in those countries saying, I want to be free. A lot of them felt that even though, because, you know, fathers, these father figures are also punitive figures. They're punishing. They punish bad children. So what we want to be is confident adults within a political system that, what did Bob Dylan say? Don't follow leaders, watch your parking meters. All right, thanks a lot. Appreciate your call. 313-298-WRIF. All right, it's Night Call. You're on the air. Good evening.
Hey, Pete. How you doing?
Doing well.
Good. Good to hear you. Real quick, even before I even forget, I wanted just on the air thank the Riff for having you and the show on. You know, I don't think that's mentioned enough. I've got an idea.
Sure.
I want to start designing a flag for the defeatist Americans, the ones who just kind of, I work at a store.
Mm-hmm.
I work at a convenience store, and my coworker and I, we decided one day that out of out of 100 people polled, you know, if you talk to them as you're cashing them out there at the store, if you, out of 100 people polled, 100 people will tell you that 100% of politicians are crooked. You know, you pretty much have this agreement on that all the way across the board, and at one point you either, you have a decision to make, and a lot of people just take the darker decision, in my opinion, and they just throw their hands up and, oh, there's nothing I can do, and, you know, it just this defeatism. I mean, I think that's the right word, isn't it?
Well, it is, but it's partly based on experience. You know, there, in other countries, they have a long tradition of opposition to governments, you know, based in trade unions, based in churches, based in popular-based movements, say like the Green Movement, the Greens in Germany in the 1980s. But we've been pretty much fragmented and atomized so that each of us approaches the world and the political structure and the economic system as this lone fragment, this individual that assesses ourselves as to whether we've, quote, made it or not as a personal failing, even though, you know, you can say that there's 50, 60 million poor people in this country, even though you can say that, you know, that Bush has presided over the loss of 3 million jobs, and the ones that have replaced them, which aren't anywhere near 3 million, are at less pay, and on and on and on like that. But if there's not really a movement that articulates that and has a vision of a different way to run our affairs, and that doesn't mean, I mean, you know, I accept the idea of anybody but Bush, you know, in the next election, but we're not going to solve our problems by having John Kerry or John Edwards or or John Dean in. In other countries, but, you know, if they're going to start cutting wages or raising university tuition, the people know that this is something that doesn't have to be put on the backs of middle class and working class families, and they'll bring out hundreds of thousands of people into the streets, or truckers will, in France block highways and what have you, and or in Argentina when tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of people come out, banging pots and pans. That's what does something. That's what a popular-based movement does. Like, and the real movements for social change in this country have always been grassroots movements. And then, you know, the leaders go, oh, yeah, that's what I believe, too, so they can get their butt elected.
Yeah. But here in this country, I mean, those people are just those dirty protesters, those people that are, you know, just, oh, there they go again, those stupid protesters. But anyway, before I let you go, I just wanted to get your thoughts on Wham. You know, I'm calling from Ipsy here, and I just wanted to know, what you thought of all this, because, I mean, the station manager up there is, you know, working also for Clear Channel, so that pretty much creates the whole monopoly there. I mean, the biggest fears, it was all over the newspaper, you know, and even the FCC was dragging its feet on, you know, Clear Channel buying that station.
This is WAAM in Ann Arbor, this, like, 5,000-watt station,
yeah,
that does talk radio. So what's the big item about it?
Well, it was just kind of the last peg as far as the last nail in the coffin, I guess would be a better way of putting it.
Okay.
Just, you know, everybody in Washtenaw County now gets their news from them, from Clear Channel.
Oh, I see.
And you have, I mean, I guess you know, other than your college radio kind of, you know, I mean, there's really not the monopoly's there. It's really in essence.
Gotcha.
It's all over Washtenaw County now.
Well, one of the things that's happened traditionally, and now we depend so much on the media, I mean, the Internet, of course, is always a good source, and people are depending increasingly on that. I mean, most people that are left of center, which is the majority of people, certainly the majority of people in Washtenaw County and Wayne County and Oakland County, Macomb County, we see by the voting patterns, They don't listen to Rush Limbaugh. You know, you got the, what I always say in this program. You got a third of the people that can be fooled all the time, and they want to, you know, they're in this polemic against reality, and these media whores like Limbaugh and Hannity and what have you, they give them the arguments because, I mean, it's pretty clear. You know, that Bush lied about the weapons of mass destruction. It's pretty clear that the economy's doing well for the stockholders, but not for the average person. And so they give him the arguments. They say, well, gee, how can I still be a loyal subject of the rich and powerful when nothing they're saying makes sense? And then they tune in every day and they go, here's the reason why. And they go, oh, yeah, well, thank you. Now I have a reason. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. Moving onward. Hi. Night call, and you're on the air. Good evening.
Good evening, Pete. My name's Joe. How's it going?
Hi, Joe.
Hey, Pete, I got some insight for you regarding a minute ago you were talking about how lower-income Americans are actually paying a larger percentage of their income in taxes versus higher-income people
mm-hmm.
who pay lower percentages. The reason I can give you such good insight is because that fits me exactly, I hate to say.
Which?
I am now disabled, and I am now on Social Security, and I have worked all my life. And I've worked at these low-end, low-paying jobs, even though they've been professional. Nothing's ever been over $10 an hour.
Wow.
And now at this point in my life, I'm finding my Social Security is so pathetically bad that it's beyond, my rent is more than my Social Security check. And that's true because I'm in public assisted housing now. And regarding the cost of living wage you were talking about earlier, Ann Arbor City also has a cost of living wage. They're saying $12.75 an hour is what it takes, and they're passing a city ordinance to where anybody that employs anyone within the city limits has to pay them at least $12.75 an hour or above, or they're not allowed to employ people because that is the cost of living. You know.
Well, that's what we need is a national law like that.
Exactly.
And when I just talk to people, I mean, I live in a kind of upper working class, lower middle class city, suburb. And the people that I talk to that have lost their jobs, a woman's going to have to, same thing with you. She's become disabled and she's going to have to sell her house or it's going to be foreclosed. And I just think, what a cruel system. I mean, it's like feudalism, where, you know, the lords live the high life, and the peasants were just kind of screwed. And here, I mean, there's still probably a bulk of people. I'm not trying to say that, you know, you just have like this 1% of ultra-wealthy lords and 99% of us are living like crap. I don't. But you see enough of it that it begins to characterize the kind of society we live in. Because I'm trying to think who it was that we judge a society by how it deals with the least fortunate among us. And as I said earlier, when we have tens of millions of poor people, including millions and millions of kids, of working families that don't make enough to have even a working class life, let alone a middle class life. And then when we have people that have, you know, through misfortune or accident or something like that, are forced to depend on the generosity of the community, it's not there. And it's not that the community isn't generous. It's that money is going elsewhere. It's going, in this case, it's going to, you know, Bush's buddies in Iraq.
Well, see, and that's something where the American people's got to stand up and take a stand on. And I think the difference now is going to be, as opposed to protesters in the 60s actually having effect, now I think it's going to be a rioting situation, and FEMA's going to get involved, and it's going to turn into, you know, something very negative.
Well, I hope it doesn't get to that. I mean, that certainly all those riots, I forget whether there was like a 200 riots in America, including, of course, a big one in the United States. And, I mean, it did act as a wake-up call, and there was some attempt at ameliorating things. But as you'll see by this first interview that I do, beginning at 1 o'clock, it certainly hasn't solved the problem. Joe, I got to move on because just got a minute or so left. Thanks for having joined us on WRIF, and our next caller is right here. Hi, it's Night Call. You're on the air. Good evening.
Good evening to you, man. My name's Eric. I'm just 22, and I just got done with school and everything, and, you know, like, I'm just kind of, you know, entering this, like, political realm, you know, and everything of life and really coming to it. And I just wanted to point out, you were talking to one of your last callers, and you pointed out that, you know, like, in America, the real change that we would need would be people coming out in mass quantities and banging on pots and pans or whatever else, you know. And, you know, my father grew me up, like, surrounded by the arts and talking about, you know, the things that he went through. And I noticed that something we don't have today is great social leaders within the fine, you know, arts and humanities that we create as a society. And, you know, we don't have the Bob Marleys and the John Lennons of today taking the people and, you know, manifesting this need for social change within their art and whatever, and taking those, you know, like America to the doorstep of Washington, D.C. And, you know, just like, you know,
well,
gathering people and making the voice heard, you know, and I just...
It's kind of
Justin, you know, Timberlake cutting it, you know.
Yeah, you're right. I don't know which, it's kind of chicken and egg thing. I don't know whether... I think I know which is the chicken and which is the egg. I think the egg, which gives forth to the chicken, are these social movements. It's we found in the anti-war movements and the civil rights movement of the 60s, the union movements of the 30s, and back into our history, is that when these movements of the anti-slavery movement, so we had people like Frederick Douglass and William Lloyd Garrison or even people like Henry David Thoreau. It was the times that it forced everybody to make decisions about how they stood on the great questions of the day. Maybe it's partially that those great questions aren't being addressed directly. So the big big news turns out to be whether some guy in California killed his wife and killed his pregnant wife, and whether Janet Jackson showed too much at the Super Bowl. And then, the same newscast, that many more Americans were just killed in Iraq. There wasn't the entertainment
fact. He destroyed more weapons of mass destruction in the 90s after the Gulf War than during the Gulf War. What did they do? The UN inspectors went in there. They found large quantities of weapons, and they destroyed them.
It was the station owners.
New developments in the country.
Them and their families and their communities. But also make history, and we've done it before in our nation's development, and we can do it again. If we don't, if we just remain as objects of history that we're moved upon, is that we're the people that are the recipients of the manipulative political speech and the ads that they buy with their hundreds of millions of dollars, then we might as well give it up. I mean, why even bother to talk about it? But we can become the subjects in history. We can make history. We can do it. All right, got to go. Thank you. Thanks for being our last caller.
If you want the glory, then you better have the guts.
The Super Snowcross Stadium Tour. This Saturday,
the Silver Dome.
It's unbelievable indoor snowmobile racing.
On the harshest snowpack track ever built.
Featuring the best riders on the planet. Sean the Sniper Crapo.
Launching Levi Lavalle.
Defending champion Blair Superman Morgan and more.
See freestyler Jimmy Blaze performs a backflip live.
On his Yamaha SX Viper.
Advanced kid seats are just $10.
That's right. Advanced kid seats just $10.
So don't wait. Get your tickets now at Ticketmaster, the box office, or charge by phone at 248-645-6666.
Or online at Ticketmaster.com.
Tickets subject to convenience and handling charges.
All seats $2 off with a free pit pass with advanced purchase.
It's a snow flying, paint scraping, snowmobile racing showdown.
The Super Snowcross Stadium Tour.
Presented by Parts Unlimited
and Bud Light.
This Saturday,
the Silver Dome.
Now, here's the host of Night Call, Peter Werby, on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Good morning. Thank you very much for joining me. One of the things that comes up as the number one concern of all of you when we do our tests here at this station, you direct the programming, because we do tests on representative groups of our listeners, and you tell us what you are most concerned about. And gee, guess what? It's not about gay marriage. It's not even about the war in Iraq. It's about the economy. It's about employment. It's about our expectations of what is going to happen to our lives and our communities in the days to come. We're told that there's an incredible recovery. Now, I'd like to talk in general about that, but specifically with a guest in our studios today. And his name is Diedrich Mohammed. He is the coordinator of the Racial Wealth Divide Project, and it's a project of United for a Fair Economy. We've had lots of guests on from that wonderful group before. And Diedrich Mohammed, thanks for joining me.
Yes, thank you for having me.
Now, you have authored, after a lot of research, a paper called The State of the Dream 2004, Enduring Disparities in Black and White. And I almost feel awful that I have to begin with this proviso, but people in many ways don't have that sense of community anymore, and I sort of get fearful as we start to tell what you found in terms of this divide, that Euro-Americans listening will be saying, well, it doesn't affect me, or, well, it's too bad, but life's tough. So I urge you to stay with this all and to understand what happens to some of us ultimately happens to the vast majority of us. You think that's fair to say?
No, I think that's absolutely correct. I think the economic policies that hurt the weakest of citizens first, it hits them the strongest in the beginning, but then it goes throughout all of American society, and I think we're seeing that with many factors of the job loss economy that's happening today.
Now, I just saw a review in the New York Times today of a new book called The End of Blackness by Deborah J. Dickerson. Are you familiar with that at all?
I've read the same article.
Okay. And essentially she was saying it's time to get over these racial things, and to some extent, that's appealing to me in that I think we ought to be looking at class factors, that there has been a rise, for instance, in the African-American-based middle class over the last 30 years. But I was astounded to see these figures that you brought up in the State of the Dream 2004. And, I mean, you almost could just spend the next 15 minutes reading them off, but I don't think that would probably be the most exciting radio. But tell me that in your study, what you found the most surprising to you, because we're told pretty much is that racial discrimination is over, that we're at the level playing field.
I first want to say, I think most people would like to get past this this race thing, get past the racial divide, and that's the idea of the project, is to try to create a situation in which the country could finally get past the racial division, the racial apartheid that marks so much of the social indicators of how people live. And this report was based on this kind of idea. It's to look at the State of the Dream report, to look at, as President Bush was putting out a State of the Union a day after the official holiday for Martin Luther King, we wanted to put out a State of the Dream and see how far we've progressed from 1968, when Dr. King was brutally killed, to today. And the sad fact is that we're not past race, that African Americans at every level, even the black middle class, are still very far apart in most social indicators from the white middle class. And so we feel it is important, so that we can get past this race thing, that we we highlight the issue that there still is a stark difference, and what kind of social policies can be put forward to help us get past this difference, and help, and then maybe we can unite as Americans as a whole.
You know, maybe just even before we could begin, before we begin with some of these statistics, and I still want you to tell me which one you found the most startling. I found many of them startling. Papa Doc Duvalier, the brutal U.S.-supported dictator of Haiti, probably a generation ago, was asked, what percentage of Haitians are white? And he said, 97%. And he says that, you have like almost an all-black nation. He said, I'm using the same standards you are in America, the single drop of blood theory. Mm-hmm. Now, you, if you don't mind me saying so, Dietrich, if you were in Brazil, you'd be probably considered white. If you were in South Africa, you'd be considered colored. And if you're here in the United States, you're black.
That is correct.
How does one sort that all out, either emotionally as an individual?
I guess it would be more confusing if I lived part of my life in Brazil, lived part of my life in, you know, since I've lived, I've traveled throughout the world and I have seen the different ways people respond to you, but I've primarily lived in the United States, and it's quite clear, it's never been unclear to me that I was black.
Yeah.
It was never, when I've been arrested, when I've been pulled over, it was quite clear what ethnic group they were putting me in.
So this is, what we're talking about is a socially defined category. It doesn't have to do with skin hue or anything like that.
Race, ethnic groups, cultures is always socially defined, and it varies from society to society. The sad thing is, though, we do see a factor of white supremacy throughout the world. We see different ways ways that it's applied. We see in Haiti, the people who might consider themselves light might be considered black here. But there still is this idea that people who are closer to European ancestry should have privilege in societies throughout the world. And that is something, the racial wealth divide isn't just, even though this report focuses on the racial wealth divide as a domestic concern, and particularly between blacks and whites, racial wealth divide is a global concern. I think you see the globalization movement also dealing with that, maybe not in such stark racial terms, but in fact, they are dealing with the racial wealth divide globally.
All right, let's go to your study, The State of the Dream 2004, Enduring Disparities in Black and White. And again, let me frame the discussion in the sense that people think racial discrimination, not only is it illegal, but it, you know, everywhere we look, we see integration. Every time we turn on the television for a sitcom or the news. And so I think people fairly would be surprised. What struck you the most?
I think what struck me and what struck our project the most was we thought that a lot more progress had been made in income. Because you do hear so much about the black middle class, mm-hmm. and you would assume that that would pull up black income to a level much closer to whites. But we did the research, and we saw that in 1968, African Americans made 55 cents on the white dollar. In 2002, I think 2001 actually, African Americans had progressed to making 57 cents on the white dollar. And we really found that astounding, that after over 30 years, only 2 cents had African Americans caught up. And at this rate, it would take another 581 years for African Americans to reach parity with whites in per capita income. And that, I think, really kind of summarizes generally, there's some small progress being made, but it's so slow, it's hard to even call it progress. And I'd like to point out that Martin Luther King put out a book in 1964 called Why We Can't Wait. And 40 years later, we're still waiting. It looks like we might have to wait several other centuries for there to be some kind of economic equality between the races, and we don't feel that's acceptable.
Well, how can we pin this down? I mean, the most charitable would say it's because of, say, lack of education, that a lot of people of African ancestries are still rooted in the inner cities that have poor services, poor schools, and what have you. The less thoughtful and racist might say it's lack of initiative. So that there's a lot, I mean, people, I think, recognize that that people of African ancestry are disproportionately represented, particularly in the urban poor, even forgetting about the whole swath of rural, and have, and I'm talking about Euro-Americans now, and have a variety of explanations to themselves why this occurs.
People have always had explanations for white supremacy and why blacks were at the bottom of society, and usually it goes to what I consider a racist understanding. I think oftentimes the putting forth that, you know, if blacks just worked harder, studied harder, that then there would be equality ignores the fact that white supremacy didn't come just from European Americans working hard, but came from hundreds of years of institutional support, of giving millions, billions of dollars of federal program money specifically to white people, which allowed them to create wealth and create the great middle class that came at the expense of many people of color. And the only way to really deal with this issue is once again to turn to the government to invest in the people of color in the way that they had invested in white people for so long, and then maybe we can start seeing some more equality. I mean, you pointed out education. That's one thing, surprisingly enough, where we see some of the best success happening. We see now that in I think as much as as little as 10 years, the dropout rate for African Americans will be equivalent to that of white Americans if the rates continue as the same. It's dropped almost 50% of the dropout rate of high school for African Americans, while white Americans have stayed pretty much the same over the last 40 years. So we see where there aren't barriers like costs, primarily cost barriers into education. We see African Americans making the greatest success, but we see that even when they succeed in higher education, an African American with a college degree is likely to make $500,000 less in a lifetime than a white American with a college degree, and with a post-bachelor's degree will make $600,000 wow. less in a lifetime than a white person. So we see that discrimination is still a strong factor. So not only is there discrimination, they're also starting 10 steps behind the starting line. And so, again, we have to decide as a society, is this something we care about? Do we care about equality? When we celebrate Dr. King's birthday, do we just want to dismiss the man in his dream, or do we want to make that a reality?
Now, prejudice and stereotypes are obviously a key component of racism as the rationale for the system. But people often confuse the two. That is to say that that people confuse the dislike of another group as with actually a structure of racism. And I don't know if I'm saying this clearly. What I want to get to is that race becomes one of the key mechanisms in the maldistribution of wealth. I mean, there's X amount of wealth available. How's it going to be split up? Well, if you can privilege white males over white females and in a whole class of brown and black people, there's a lot more that can accrue to the privileged group. Now, you could make the argument, if you didn't have a conscience, if you didn't have a strong set of ethics, you could say, wait a minute, I'm a white guy. There's a, this economy is so uncertain. We're being run by these guys that are so whacked out to give all the money away to the wealthy. I've got a vested interest in keeping things as they are.
Well, if you want to keep things as they are, meaning that your manufacturing jobs, lower white-collar jobs are being exported around the world so people there can make $2 an hour for these jobs that used to pay $10 to $30 an hour, then I guess as a white male, if you want that, then you could fight for that. But I think generally we're seeing that the policies that are for the most privileged of society, for the most elite, most white males are not elite. They are not millionaires. But they will suffer under the same kind of policy. Let's take some of these tax cuts, for example. The tax cuts that benefit millionaires primarily and take away income to help provide social services that most Americans need to help create a middle-class situation for future generations is hurting all Americans. It disproportionately hurts African Americans, but it hurts all Americans, and I think that was one great thing we saw with the Civil Rights Movement. The Civil Rights Movement really pushed forth policies to advance African American people and poor people as a whole, and we see a dramatic decrease in poverty rates. We see a dramatic decrease in infant mortality rates that happen for blacks and whites. And so the Civil Rights Movement has always been something that has been very beneficial for all of society, actually particularly white women. Some people argue white women have gained more of the Civil Rights Movement than even African Americans.
Hmm. Diedrich Muhammad is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show, and he's the coordinator of the Racial Wealth Divide Project of United for a Fair Economy. If you go to their website, faireconomy.org, it's there, Diedrich?
That is correct.
All right, let's go back to some of these statistics, and I don't know if you have them right at your fingertips, but they're absolutely astounding, and things that we associated more with conditions 40 years ago. Maybe you could just the ones that maybe struck you the most as
sure. One thing we see is with the unemployment rate. We see the African American unemployment rate has stayed steady at twice that of white America. White America has had around a 5% unemployment rate. That seems to be what the government deems as an acceptable unemployment rate. What's acceptable for African Americans is 10%. And I think now there's even greater concern, again, with this idea of a job loss economy. As globalization is happening and we're seeing that now the competition isn't just domestic but is more and more international, that this kind of development is going to be a greater threat to all of America. So we see that there hasn't been much progress made at all in that area.
By the way, I should say welcome to Detroit, where we've just been told that the city of Detroit, which is primarily an African-American city, the unemployment rate is 15%. I mean, those are depression level, and that's official. If you no longer register with the government as unemployed.
It doesn't include discouraged workers. It doesn't include those who work kind of in an underground economy. Uh-huh. And it doesn't include people who are imprisoned or these kind of things. I mean, if there have been studies about discouraged workers stats, and we see usually it's about double that of the unemployment rate. So you're probably looking more at around a 30% unemployment rate in Detroit. And that's. And I guess a question this report really wants to highlight is, why is this not even a national concern? Like, why isn't this even on a table that America is in a crisis? There isn't just a crisis about a war on terrorism, or there isn't just issues about should we go to Mars or not, but there's a crisis that there's massive unemployment in this country.
Well, we want to know whether Scott Peterson killed his wife.
No. And do we want to know that, or do we want to know why that now, 40 years after Dr. King died, we have the mother and father working full-time jobs, sometimes taking an extra part-time job, but still can't live as well as the parents did during Martin Luther King's lifetime? I think that is a question that really does bother a lot of people. And as you said, I think it's reflecting the fact that people are more and more concerned about economic issues. And that is why United for a Fair Economy exists, to try to help bring some economic analysis and economic explanation to the average man and woman in the United States. And so they can see how these policies are hurting them or helping them.
Can we just look at that phrase, discouraged worker? I think I kind of indicated that when I've been on unemployment before, I actually fortunately haven't been in quite a few years, but you got your state unemployment, but then you had to go over to the federal little sector of the building and you'd register and you know, you'd say, well, like I said, I wanted a job as a DJ. You know, they said, well, we don't have a category for that. And I went, well, but and as soon as my unemployment ran out, I stopped registering with the federal side. I had to do that every week. And so they counted me as a discouraged worker, although I wasn't discouraged. That's the official category. So, I mean, the idea somehow is that your unemployment runs out and you think, shucks, man, I'm never going to get a job. But that's not true. They must have Arthur Anderson doing the accounting for the unemployed.
Well, I mean, and I think if we do further analysis in the economic figures, we'll see that oftentimes it's skewed not to really show the average situation of the average man and woman. Again, there's this talk about a great economic recovery, and I guess there is a great economic recovery, just the people that are suffering. And that's what we really need to look at, is how does these economic policies, these economic terms relate to the lives of the average man and woman? I mean, the fact, again, that the average man and woman have to work many more hours together than they did 40 years ago to make the same kind of income shows to me that the economy of the United States is not doing well. Just because millionaires are being produced, to me, is not the economic indicator I want to determine how I live. I want to see how my public education is. Do my children after me have a chance to live a lifestyle equal to mine or better to mine? I think at that level, most Americans will say that the economy isn't going well.
Well, I don't know if you ever sat around in the dorms if you went to a college like I did. I went to Michigan State University, and you know, like 2 a.m, when you're a sophomore, you're asking, you know, what is reality? You know, you've got all these different theories, and that's an important question. I heard this phrase that power is the ability to define reality, and so we live in a totally mediatized world. And which puts up in front of us Scott Peterson and...
Or even Saddam Hussein and weapons of mass destruction is a national crisis, which the country should sacrifice 500 soldiers' lives, should sacrifice hundreds of billions of dollars of lives, but the fact that a third of African-American children are born into poverty is not even something worth commenting, not even something worth putting on the television. That's a real skewed imbalance way of looking at America, and if we really want to embrace, I think, King's legacy and what's best in America, we would want to kind of go back to King's vision of an America for all people and reevaluate what kind of things we think are our top priorities.
Well, then there was a popular-based movement, and people didn't even need the media. I mean, I saw a documentary about Bayard Rustin's life, a great civil rights leader, and they were retelling the story of the Montgomery bus boycott. Well, obviously, they were getting nothing but bad press in the Birmingham, Alabama media at that time, and yet they communicated convivially, I mean, among one another. During the, you know, later in the 60s, that continued, but also there was pretty much a positive presentation on the corporate media of the civil rights movement, because people knew at least superficially that there had to be some changes. Whereas now, I suspect, things I read, is that people take these failures upon themselves as individual ones. If my job isn't, if I get fired, or if I can't buy as much as I, you know, used to be able to, that's my fault. I mean, because we live in an America that's race-free, so there is a sense that this is visiting us as individuals rather than a mass phenomenon.
No, and I think that is one thing that we're trying to educate people more and more on, is that the wealth of the United States didn't just happen by individuals independently working with each other, but oftentimes was really developed by massive government policy. We saw the greatest increase in home ownership rate happen after World War II, when there was a Federal Housing Act, which was designed for the soldiers when they came back home from World War II to become homeowners. We need that kind of active government, involved government that's focused on helping bringing the American middle class dream to most of its citizens, and we seem to have stepped away from that now and come to a government that's really only there to protect the the estates of the rich and the wealthy, which hurts most Americans and hurts African Americans in particular.
Well, it's clear we can't do that. If we're talking about making $1 trillion in tax cuts permanent, $700 billion to go to Mars, another $500 trillion for missile defense, it's pretty clear where this is going. This is military Keynesianism. That old, maybe I shouldn't even introduce that, but the idea that the government transfers private wealth to, you know, to elements within the economy. And so rather than doing it to, as you said, that would empower homeowners, which then would have to employ construction workers, it's all going to be in this pretty much capital-intensive, labor-scarce aerospace war industries.
No, there's a debate about this idea of trickle-down economics, which is the idea that by making the rich more rich, that's the best way to benefit society. And there's an idea of a bottom-up, where you deal with the average man and woman in the United States, you try to help make their lives better, you create government policies thinking about them, and that'll improve the lot of America. United for a Fair Economy believes in a bottom-up, that we should focus on middle-class America, working-class America, and that's what makes America great. We don't believe in a trickle-down where, as Reverend Al Sharpton, a man I used to work for, always says, that we've had the trickle for the last 20 years, and all it seems to do is bring us further down. And so I think he's absolutely right on that.
We can turn a phrase. Well, maybe we can take a poll of our radio listeners. Everybody that wants to enrich the wealthy even further, please raise your hand. I see a few out there, not very many. How about those that think that we ought to start with the needs of the average American, the middle class, the working class, and the working poor? Now, a lot of you agreeing to that. One of the, and maybe you could talk about the impact of your study on black families. Bush is going to allocate $1.5 billion to promote marriage, and we have the situation in many poor African American communities where an intact family is actually odd, and a single parent is the norm. How has that progressed over the years?
Well, actually, I think it's generally throughout the United States society, single-parent families are more and more common and predominant. It's not something just in the African-American community. And I think oftentimes people confuse the class aspect of the African-American situation with a racial aspect. African-Americans generally behave the same way as white Americans if you compare their class. A lower-class African-American has many similar behaviors as a lower-class white American. Just the problem is such a strong percentage of African-Americans are lower class or born in poverty. I mean, 25% of African-Americans live in poverty. You find those in poverty are the most likely to have single-family homes, single-parent households. So the answer to all of this is to start ending this racial wealth divide, start moving these people out of poverty, and you will see an increase in educational attainment. You'll see an increase in two-family homes, these kind of issues. Bush's $1.5 billion doesn't even cover like a hundredth of the tax cut he wants to give to millionaires so that they can invest in whatever they believe will make themselves richer in the future. So we see these are Band-Aid problems to gushing wounds, when we really need much more than an investigation into the morality of single-parent family homes is to create a situation where a single-parent family can send their kids to college, or even a two-parent family can be guaranteed to send their kids to college.
Well, United for a Fair Economy, if we ever are going to attain anything approaching a fair economy, we're off in a direction that makes it impossible, with a $500 trillion deficit, with programs for the poor being cut, even veterans care being cut. This thrust United for a Fair Economy into certainly not a self-help group, but a very overtly political organization that's got to say no to the direction we're off in.
Well, I mean, United for Fair Economy has always been about policy, been about economic policy that's focused on the middle-class American. We don't believe that it's good for any of America to go into billions of dollars of deficit and at the same time cut social programs that help the weakest of America. We found that in the 30s and 40s there was great support to help working class America with Social Security, these kind of programs. And we believe that Americans still want that today, and so that's what we do here at United for a Fair Economy.
Dietrich Mohammed, thanks for being with us. Dietrich Mohammed is the coordinator of the Racial Wealth Divide Project of United for a Fair Economy. And you can go to faireconomy.org. There'll also be a link on my site, peterwerbe.com. That's W-E-R-B-E. Dietrich Mohammed, thanks for being with us in the studio.
Thank you very much.
You're logged on at WRIF.com. We'll get back to more Riff Raff in just a moment.
Hello, How are you?
What you missed from Drew and Mike in the morning.
We tried calling this guy, got this woman, and she made the mistake of hanging up on us.
We didn't hear goodbye. Why'd you hang up?
I have company and I am busy.
Oh, well, you say usually when people hang up, I don't know if you're new, if you just got citizenship, usually people say goodbye before they hang up the telephone.
I did. I told you I had to go.
I remember you were laughing about the erection, but...
No, I said I had to go. No, and people, I'm hanging up. Goodbye.
People usually, yeah, say goodbye.
Wait,
that's good. You learn.
Yeah, okay.
She didn't have any company. What is
God,
she talking about?
Company.
Liar.
Yeah, I know. People lie in a...
let's call back and say we're a caterer. And if she says, there's nobody over here, they'll say, liar!
Let me tell you what's really going to happen. Yeah. You're going to call up as the so-called caterer, and she's going to be, I just talked to you. I said goodbye.
You never know.
If it's in Vegas as a bet, I'm not so sure I'm going to put any money on this.
Hello?
Yeah, I'm looking for you. This is a caterer. You having a party over there?
Not today.
By God.
You lied. You said you had company, lady.
I have company, but I don't have a party going on.
That's hilarious.
You lied.
You lied.
You lied.
That sounds good.
And Mike.
Hey.
In the morning.
Each of us has to set his own standards, I guess.
On the Rift.
That's good.
101.1 WRIF.
Ow, you're shouting at me.
The Motor City's best rock station, 101 WRIF, and the best radio website in the world, WRIF.com, brings the hottest deals in the Motor City. Now,
a cliche is that after September 11th, everything has changed. It has to some extent, and in other ways, time has a way of making us forget the emotions that came out of that day. We may remember how frightened we were, how angry we were, whatever arose during that period. Things as they move along begin to not have the same impact that they did. However, if you were directly affected, just like all of us will certainly remember where we were on that particular day when we heard the awful news, the people related to those people that were lost, it's riveted a little more deeply in their mind. Joining me is David Petorti. He lost his brother Jim in the attack on the North Tower of the World Trade Center on September 11th. And David Petorti is been a journalist, a television and radio writer and producer. And he lives in North Carolina where we're talking to him. And he's one of the founders of an organization called September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. And one of the reasons for this conversation is that David Petorti will be in this coming Tuesday, February 3rd, the Bookbeat Bookstore. The Bookbeat Bookstore, it's in the Lincoln Shopping Center at Greenfield and Lincoln Streets in Oak Park. It's a pleasure to welcome David Petorti. David, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thanks, Peter.
I should say, and I am going to let you get a word in edgewise, I promise, that you have also published a very powerful book called September 11th, Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, Turning Our Grief into Action for Peace, and it's published by Akashic Publishers. You've probably, in fact, I know, I've interviewed you before in different venues, and when you've told this story so many times about that fateful day and the fate of your brother, how does it feel now telling it? Has it lost any of its impact on you?
Oh, not at all. It's always very emotional, and it's always very hard to talk about. But I think it's something that we have to remember and talk about. And I always, I talk about him working in the North Tower, and that first plane went right into his office, which was Martian McLennan office, and they lost about 300 employees that day, so they pretty much lost their whole office. And I do talk about it because, as you were suggesting a little bit earlier, I think human beings are so resourceful and adaptive that we forget how weird it was in the fall of 2001, and the fact that there was anthrax getting sent around in the mail, and all these things were happening, and we didn't know what was happening or when they would stop. And I just remember how scared everybody was and how uncertain we were about our future. And so many questions remain unanswered about how the attacks happened and where the anthrax came from. And somehow 2 years later, we still don't have those answers, but we're just kind of getting on with our lives, and it's really quite weird, and that's part of why we wrote
The book was just to remind people of how strange it was to try to be patriotic in the middle of all of that fear and stress, and how ordinary people like us, because I consider myself a totally ordinary person, was put into this extraordinary situation where the whole attention of the world was on us. And I think it's important to remember that stuff and to really come to some closure with it, because so many things have yet to be answered.
Now, David Battardi, the period following September 11th and the reality of the loss of your brother sunk in, what were your emotions? Obviously, great grief and sadness. So many people had this desire for revenge, and yet you began a group called September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. Did you have that sense of somebody has to pay for my brother's death?
Well, I was angry, and I think, to be totally honest with you, I was angry that this sort of thing could have happened in a country that was spending $1 billion a day on national defense. So to be totally honest with you, I was angry at how did these people get on those airplanes, and how is it that we have all these jet fighters on 24-hour-a-day alert outside of Washington, and there was virtually no response to these attacks that day. So that's really what I was angry about, why my own country didn't protect us in a better way. I couldn't be angry at the people that did this because it was obviously a suicide mission and they all killed each other. But I wanted to know more about how this could happen, what the connections were, you know, business connections or business dealings that were behind it. And then I started reading about there are stock trades that had occurred just before 9/11, and apparently people knew that the planes were going to crash and they were betting that stocks would go down. And all of these questions started coming into my mind. But at the same time, I had this personal reaction, which is the same as anybody that that loses a family member to murder, which is that we didn't want anybody else to have to endure this kind of suffering. Because this is just, you know, to lose somebody is horrible, but to lose somebody to an act of murder is even more horrible, because you think that it didn't have to happen or it was mm-hmm. just a coincidence. So my reaction was a personal reaction, which was shared by the other people that would form my group, which is that we didn't want other people to suffer, and we didn't want the bombing of Afghanistan to take the lives of a lot of innocent Afghans.
Well, you know, I've actually interviewed people over the years, some people that have been against capital punishment, that spoke out against the execution of people that had killed their loved ones, sometimes even in a hideous manner. And on the other hand, very frequently, people want that blood debt paid. They want the state to exact the same pound of flesh that was taken from them. So how did, I don't know, I mean, how have other families or other individuals related to September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows that didn't want a peaceful tomorrow, that wanted this act, whether it is national security or vengeance, their loved ones died, someone else should suffer similarly?
Well, we've certainly heard about people that wanted revenge, and I remember there was one of our members did a report on TV, and she was joined by another woman who had lost her husband, I think, and she actually had his name painted on the side of a bomb that was dropped on Afghanistan, and she was talking about how satisfying that was to know that that bomb was being dropped with her husband's name on it. And I thought to myself, well, maybe that bomb was going to fall on somebody's house and kill somebody else's husband. I obviously didn't think that bombing was going to capture the bad guys the way that they predicted it would. We haven't had a lot of interaction with families that disagree with us. There are a lot of, I imagine there's a lot of people that disagree with us in terms of family members. We did hear from a group called Murder Victims Families for Reconciliation right away, and they're a group in Boston, which is exactly what you were talking about, people who have lost loved ones to murder and are against the death penalty. And one of them is named Bud Welch, and it was great meeting him because he talked about losing his daughter in the Oklahoma City bombing and how he went through a couple of years of terrific grief and wanting vengeance, and a lot of other people from that group wanted vengeance. And then at a certain point, he realized that he had to meet Timothy McVeigh's father and have some sort of connection with him as the father of the man that killed his daughter. And he said it wasn't until he found Timothy McVeigh's father and actually went to his house and met with him that he was able to
kind of close the circle and say, look, we're connected through this horrible, violent tragedy, and we've got to do something better. And I think he's done speaking events with Timothy McVeigh's dad and his sister, too. And I think that's how it's been with us. You know, there's just no good to come out of killing other people. There's no satisfaction from that vengeance, in terms of me, anyway, because it doesn't really accomplish anything. There's no idea of rehabilitation or changing them or turning them into something better, or at least just putting them away where they can't hurt other people. And the problem with the course our country has taken, I think, which is just to bomb, is that you wind up killing a lot more innocent people, and I think that just creates more problems and makes the things worse for us, because we feel like it's being done in our names, and we don't want it to be done.
David Petardi, you visited Afghanistan along with other September 11th families, and I wonder, and this is strange, we always almost know to the person how many of our soldiers have been killed, like in Iraq. I think it's like 510 now. But I think if we said to somebody, how many Afghan civilians were killed, probably 99% who had never even heard of Osama bin Laden, or knew that he was had residence in the country of Afghanistan, yet they were collateral damage. Any figure of how many Afghan civilians died?
Well, I know there are websites, iraqbodycount.org, I think, is one of them. The latest figures I've heard, and these are culled from various reports in the Middle East, is I think 4,000 people killed in Afghanistan and more than 10,000 civilians killed in Iraq. And, you know, when it came to my brother's death, the thing that really bothered me is how dehumanizing his death was, that it was like he didn't matter. But I knew him as a real person with a wife and plans for the future. And when we talk about the other innocent people in Iraq and Afghanistan, and we don't even acknowledge their deaths, or we don't even pretend to want to investigate their deaths, that's also dehumanizing, because those people aren't guilty of anything. They just happen to be living in the wrong place at the wrong time under these bad dictators and various other people that came into their countries. And so part of what we try to do, and we've sent four people to Afghanistan, and then two others went. A member of our group just got back from Afghanistan after going there 2 years ago. And we basically just try to call attention to the fact that people are dying, and that we do need to be responsible in terms of helping them rebuild their countries and make their lives better. And in a big way, we really haven't done that. And Daryl Bodley, who lost his daughter on Flight 93 on September 11th, he went to Afghanistan in January of 2002. He just got back from a trip in January of 2004, and he visited some of the people that he met when he went 2 years ago. And there was one woman who lost her son when a bomb came through the roof of her house. You know, obviously it went off course, and it was a U.S. bomb, and it killed her son. And he said 2 years later, nothing has changed. She still has health problems. Her other son is unemployed. Her house has not been repaired. She's renting out a couple rooms in her house to try to make some money. And her life, I guess she lost her husband years earlier in the Mujahideen wars against Russia. And her life really hasn't changed. And I think we've got to pay attention to that, because that is where terrorism comes from in the future. When you give people no sense of hope for their future, those are the kind of people that are going to do all these crazy things and fly planes into buildings. So we've got to make sure that we give people something to live for, and if we do have to use military force, which I suppose in some cases we might, we've got to make sure that innocent people at least get a good deal on the other end, and we give them some help.
Now, things have just gone to hell in Afghanistan, and doesn't look too much better in Iraq as of this moment. David Petardi is my guest. He lost a brother on September 11th. At the World Trade Center, and he's written September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, Turning Our Grief into Action for Peace, and their website is peacefultomorrows.org. I'll have that on my website as well, peterwerbe.com, W-E-R-B-E.com. Now, you alluded, David, to why this occurred. I mean, that obviously that security was so lax. I mean, we know the circumstances of it all, and there are so many unanswered questions. And I won and if you were talking about a little about the internet websites, I mean, you go to websites and people will say this was, you know, a purposeful plan of George W. Bush, that he was behind it all, that Cheney was behind it all, that it was, they could have stopped it, they had prior information. You said people, somebody knew that they made, people made lots of money on stocks because of this. Where do you fall in terms of seeing, how would you say it, malign responsibility? In other words, that this was either, do you hold to the view that this was perpetrated by people in the American government, that the American government allowed it to happen, or that it was totally innocent of this? And it's amazing that I even have to pose these questions.
It is, isn't it? Well, I think there's only two possible answers. One is that we were absolutely incompetent because, as I said, we were spending $1 billion a day on national defense, and the idea that planes could just fly around our skies for almost 2 hours without a response certainly reflects a level of incompetence that is not acceptable. And the other possibility is that somebody knew what was going to happen and they just let it happen. And I'm really pleased to see the hearings. The 9/11 Commission is now getting a little more attention. I think they've been on C-SPAN for the past couple of days, and they're interviewing people under oath, which is good. But I don't claim to know any more than the average person knows, but I have read that that leaders from Russia, from Egypt, from Israel, actually warned our government prior to September 11th. They called George Bush and said, we have absolute information that there's going to be a massive attack. It's going to affect targets in southern Manhattan and in Washington. And they even gave the day that it was going to happen. So we know for a fact that those warnings did come. So that's something we do know. And people are on the record with saying that. So it's really hard to believe when Condoleezza Rice says we had absolutely no idea that they would use planes as weapons. When you make that sort of denial, it's just impossible to believe that that's true, because we know that there were warnings. And one of the things that has bothered me about the 9/11 Commission, the independent investigation which is going on right now, is that there has been so much resistance and foot-dragging on the part of the administration, which has said it wants to get to the bottom of this and to, you know, turn over every stone, but at the same time they've been really dragging their feet on it. And I think what bothers me now is that the commission is saying that they don't have enough time, because there has been so much foot dragging, they don't have time to finish their work by May of this year, which is when they were supposed to get done, and they've now been denied an extension by Congress. And I just cannot understand why anybody would want to prevent an investigation into the worst terrorist attack in U.S. history. Why not give them all the time they need to get to the bottom of this? And it just seems so weird that there would be this artificial limit on time, that there would be foot dragging. And I think this crosses all political boundaries, whether you're a liberal or a conservative or a Republican or a Democrat. We've got to find the answers to these questions if we're going to keep being safe in this country. And so, you know, I'm hoping that your listeners and just the general public will call their congresspeople and say, please give them an extension and please give them cooperation in getting this investigation done. I think it's just total common sense.
Well, I'll give you my shorthand view of what I think happened. I think there was a conservative coup of our government, and the plans, everything that we've seen from the invasion of Afghanistan and Iraq, the USA Patriot Act, and all of that was already on the books, pretty much, or part in the planning stages. I think it will probably come out in years to come that the Bush government said the next time that there's any attack whatsoever on the United States or its assets anywhere in the world, we're going to invade Afghanistan and occupy it. And the next time there's a pretext, we're also going to invade Iraq. I think, although some people, their conspiracy theories go way beyond this, I think that Bush and the rest of them were absolutely shocked at the level of destruction and the capacity that they had. Now, when you start talking about why didn't they scramble the jets, people say there must have been a military order for them to stand down. I have no idea whether any of that is. But I think there's long-range plans here, and this fit very neatly into it.
Well, I'm actually reading the book about Paul O'Neill now. I think it's called The Price of Loyalty.
Right.
Paul O'Neill, the insider in the Bush administration. And he talks about how they were talking about invading Iraq from day one of his administration. And so it's not a conspiracy theory. There were plans, as you say, with within the center of our government to do that.
Let's continue on, though, with when you've visited so many cities, and you and your the people in your organization, September 11th, Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, you have you know, a cachet in a sense that that just like an ordinary critic like myself does not, that says that they don't want war to avenge this, or that that the grief that you talk about in the subtitle of your book should be turned into action for peace. How do people relate to you? I mean, when the news media or people in audiences, in other words, you know, sometimes they'll say, gee, you know, Pete, you're not being patriotic, or
right,
you're not there with the program. Well, you know, you're grieving families. How are you related to?
Well, in our book, we certainly print a lot of email messages that we received early on, and we don't get a lot of angry ones anymore, but there were a lot of really nasty responses from some very extreme people at the beginning who thought we were not patriotic and said we should move to Afghanistan or whatever. But I think those are really not reflective of reality, and I have to tell you, I think people have been much more receptive than even I imagined. I was quite afraid to go out and speak initially, and we've gotten a lot of support. So I think it's another case where we have so much fear beaten into us that we're afraid to speak. But I think even you know, when we speak, the response has been so kind that there's nothing to be afraid of. And as far as the media goes, we've gotten a fair share of coverage on networks and on some of the cable networks and in newspapers, and we can't really complain about that. We wish we had more coverage. We wish they talked a little bit more about our real mission rather than just saying these are family members who have been affected and they want peace. So I think the response has been pretty good, and has been especially good from people overseas. I just got back from being in Tokyo, Japan, and Seoul, South Korea over the Thanksgiving holiday. And people there are so interested in the American peace movement, and they're actually translating our book into Japanese, and they're also translating it into Italian. But there's so much hunger out there from other countries to know that all Americans are not George Bush, because they say everything we see on television, everything we read in the newspaper is George Bush, and he is the face of America. And so when we take these trips and when we go to other countries, we almost feel like goodwill ambassadors or emissaries or diplomats or something who say all Americans are not this extreme, and you've got to remember how our country was founded and what it means to be patriotic. And they're so receptive to that, and I think people from foreign countries get it in a way that we don't. They always talk about how much they admire our freedom of speech and that we can talk to our government and disagree with it, and nobody ever says we really admire the fact that you have huge bombs and that you drop them all over the world. They admire the ideals of America. That is what they think about when they think about America, and I think we've got to get back to those ideals, because without them, they really won't care about us, and then we'll really be isolated, and we won't have any friends.
David Vittori, at the beginning, I was mentioning how time, in a sense, heals all wounds in you know, the manner of that the farther we move away from an event, no matter how what impact it has on us. I remember seeing people with tattoos that said September 11th, never forget. And I guess they'll have that there all the time. But then a little later, you mentioned about having a you know, this congressional committee or the independent committee that would investigate September 11th. When do you get to go back to being David Vittori, journalist and TV writer and what have you?
Oh, that's a really good question. You know, I still feel like September 11th was just this big explosion in my life, and that somehow I'm still up in the air and I haven't come down yet. And I think there's a lot of grieving that I still have not done for my brother. There's times when I will just break down and cry when I hear a song or something on my CD player. And that tells me that I still have a lot of grieving to do just on a personal level. And I really do miss my life that I had before, and I have two kids now, and I just realized how this is affecting their lives, the work that I'm doing, and what whether I'm available to them emotionally or not available to them. But I really see how this terrorism and war gets funneled down to other generations. And I really do miss my life. And I really look forward to a time when I won't have to be an activist, when we will have peace, and when people will really pick up the ball and do the work that we're doing. I really enjoy what I'm doing, and I feel like I'm, you know, making whatever change I can make. I'm trying to get into high schools to do teaching now. With I was just in South Carolina recently doing a panel with two military generals. One of them flew in the Gulf War and supported that war and totally opposes the Iraq War and doesn't like the current President Bush. The other one was totally supportive of the Iraq War and thought we were doing wonderful things and Iraq was a better place. And I think we've really got to start dialoguing with each other and stop talking to each other, to people that agree with us. And if I have one hope in my work, it's that people on the left and people on the right get together and start talking to each other, because we have to remember that we are all Americans and we all share the same dreams and hopes and ideals. And stop treating each other like the enemy.
Absolutely.
And if we can do that, I think then I can maybe move on and sort of get on with my life.
Well, David Bitordi, our guest, is going to be in Detroit, actually out in Oak Park, at the BookBeat bookstore. It's at 26010 Greenfield Avenue. It's in Oak Park, Michigan. It's in the Lincoln Shopping Center, essentially 10.5 and Greenfield. The book is September 11th, Families for Peaceful Tomorrows, Turning Our Grief into Action for Peace. And Michael Moore has said of it, I have so much admiration for peaceful tomorrows. People of courage and conviction, this book is a powerful reminder that the cycle of violence and retaliation can and must be broken. David Bitordi, I'll see you this coming Tuesday in Oak Park.
Great. Look for you.
Night Call is a public affairs presentation of 101 WRIF Detroit. The opinions expressed on this show do not necessarily represent those of the management or sponsors of WRIF Radio. Night Call is hosted every Sunday night by Peter Werby and produced by OD. Stay tuned for more Riff Rock coming right up on 101 WRIF Detroit.
Good morning. This is Ray Vinson of American Equity Mortgage. If you're hearing our message at this time, it's probably because you're at work, driving around, or can't sleep. If you can't sleep, I hope it's not because of money problems, but if it is a money problem, American Equity Mortgage can help. You're not alone. The average household has a credit card debt of $6,000 or more and paying a fortune in interest. You see, if you're a homeowner, you can use the equity in your home to consolidate all your bills and have only one payment. Think about that, just one new low monthly payment. Your equity can be used to pay off your auto loans, credit cards, and get a new low fixed rate on your mortgage. You will be saving hundreds of dollars each month. American Equity Mortgage specializes in homeowners with less than perfect credit. We have helped thousands of people just like you get back on track. You can call our office right now, and a loan specialist will call you first thing in the morning. That's American Equity Mortgage. Call toll-free, 888-71-LOAN-1, 888-71-L-O-A-N, then the number 1.
More nonstop Riff Rock coming up next.
Hello?
Hey, Bob. What are you doing, man?
No, I'm just leaving work. Why? What's up?
You should shoot across the border and meet me at Leopard's Lounge in Windsor. Dude, they have incredible girls from all over the world. And I'm telling you, these girls are hot.
Oh, man. I got to go across the border. I don't know.
Come on, you big baby. It's just 5 minutes from the bridge or tunnel at 1190 Wyandotte West. And get this. At Leopard's Lounge, you don't even have to pay a cover charge. Ever. Plus, they even have free parking. You got to meet me there. They have these two girls from Romania. Bro, I'm telling you, they're the friendliest girls I've ever met. Heck, all the girls at Leopard's are friendly.
Wait a minute, did you say no cover, free parking, and women from all over the world?
Bro, that's what I've been telling you. So, are you going to meet me up at Leopard's Lounge or what?
Dude, I'm so there. I'll see you in about half an hour. And hey, if you get there before me, tell the girls I'm on my way.
You got it. I'll see you at Leopard's Lounge.
Leopard's Lounge in Royal, Windsor's number one gentleman's club. Just 5 minutes from the bridge or tunnel at 1190 Wyandotte West. Call 1-888-653-8881 for Leopard's Lounge in Royal.
101 WRIF Detroit.
All right, now hear this.
Riff Rocks. Riff Rocks.
Thank you.
coming back. Did I mean to treat you bad? Yeah, but I did it anyway. So maybe some say your life was sin. Yeah, but you left it anyway. So maybe friends are standing around to watch you crumble as you fall to the ground. And yes, maybe stand inside, but you are flying. Oh, you are flying on so high. But then someday people look at you. They're what they call their own. They want you to suffer. Yeah, they hear you calling home. But then someday we can take our time. Brush your leaves aside so you can reach out. So come on, hey, but you left me far behind. Now I'm back, yeah, yeah. We might share in something great, but won't you look at where we've gone now? Won't you look at where we've grown? Then someday comes tomorrow holds a sense of what I feel for you in my mind. As I trip to find a line, in that cold day when you lost control. Jimmy left my life so soon, you should have told me. But you left me far behind, yeah. Now I'm back, yeah, 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 yeah. Did I mean to treat you so bad? Oh, but I did it anyway. Now I'm set but back, yeah, 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 yeah. Some say you're left with what you had, yeah. Oh, but you couldn't tell the pain. We'll be right back.
Your Maui Time 2004 station. 101 WRIF Detroit. The Rear.
Baby!